Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Cambridge Savings Bank. CSB is committed to improving the financial well-being of local small businesses through financial education and banking services. Learn more at cambridgesavings.com, member FDIC. And North Shore Music Theater. Audiences can experience the true story and musical journey of Frankie Valli in the Four Seasons. Jersey Boys comes to Bill Haney's North Shore Music Theater May 7th through May 19th. Tickets at nsmt.org.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio with Michael Cohen testifying before three House committees this week and speculation that Mueller could also be releasing his report soon. This could be one of the most consequential moments of Trump's presidency. On today's politics roundup, we take on this, a status update on the so-called national border emergency, and more. Then ahead of the second North Korea-U.S. summit, is Kim Jong-un ready to denuclearize? Is the U.S. ready to lower its expectations? Charlie Sennett joins us for his take on this and other global headlines.
Tech investor Roger McNamee was an early booster of Facebook. Now he's unfriending the company he helped to build. We'll talk to him about why. It's the subject of his new book, Zucked. At the Vatican summit, Pope Francis delivered on moral outrage by calling for an all-out battle against sexual abuse. But did he fail to deliver specifics on how to wage it? And all revved up, we take on this and more today on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Jim Rowdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Good morning, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie.
So, that's me.
I know who it is. Glad to see you.
Thank you.
Week ahead, by the way. We should say we're going to broadcast the Michael Cohen hearing, the public hearing, on Wednesday from end to end. So Robert Mueller's report is expected to come out sometime soon. If he doesn't release it, the Democrats have come up with a backup plan. Subpoena him. Joining us to talk about this, Michael Cohen's week of testimony, and other headlines are Jennifer Nassour, former chair of the Massachusetts GOP and current COO of Reflect Us, and and that's an organization that tries to get women in both parties to be running. Steve Kerrigan is the former head of the Democratic National Convention for Barack Obama and president and co-founder of the Massachusetts Military Heroes Fund. Steve and Jennifer, it's great to see you.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be here. Well, let's start with Robert Kraft, who, of course, owns the New England Patriots. He's supposed to be charged today, later this afternoon, of soliciting prostitution at this Florida massage parlor. I want to start with you, Jennifer, on this, because, as Jim just said, you're involved with a group of women in political things. But, you know, none of us are that far from all these terrible stories about sex trafficking. And here we have, I think the Globe first reported this, examples like this. We have this Bernadette Bruton. She's the Myra and Robert Kraft Jacob Hyatt Professor for Christian Studies at Brandeis, and her specialty is sex trafficking. So I'm not sure how Brandeis continues to have a chair from Robert Kraft, or how philanthropic groups that have anything to do with women's issues from soup to nuts can have anything to do with Robert Kraft.
If the
charges are true, and if he doesn't have some explanation about what the heck he was doing.
Yeah, I mean, so I think this brings up some interesting questions, right? So number one, you have to go with he's presumed innocent until found guilty, right? So, I mean, we'll wait and see what happens. Regardless of the level of charges, they're misdemeanor if he was just there, it's a misdemeanor. If he knew that there was some sex trafficking going on, then he would be guilty of much more. However, morally, if he was there, which it seems as though he was, but if he was legitimately there, I think then it begs a question that how do things like this continue? How does a chair for sex trafficking continue to be endowed with his name on it? And I mean, a man at his level and of his stature and with his PR team, how he doesn't know how the people around him, how his driver who dropped him off there twice doesn't know to say, this might not be a good idea because you're very recognizable. Right. And even if you put down John Smith, someone's going to know who you are. And so I think that there are just so many issues here. Maybe one of the biggest ones is, you know, when you have that much money and that much power and that much fame, Does it just go to your head and you think that you're above all of this? But, you know, at the end of the day, it goes to, are men still viewing women as sex objects and not as, not thinking that this is not the place to go? I mean, any of us pass these places and know exactly what's going on. He's not an idiot. He's a pretty successful businessman.
Yeah, I mean, on the philanthropic piece, I mean, Myra Kraft, God rest her soul, she gave a lot. She was really the philanthropic leader of that couple and that family for a long, long time. Her and her whole family, her brother and others.
The highest.
The highest, yeah.
That's what the second half of the chair from
right.
Brandeis.
And that's why I before organizations make decisions to strip the whole name off, you can easily wipe
Take
off
him.
Bob
Take him off,
and
yeah.
and just leave it be the Myra Kraft. Because I just think she should not be left in the dustbin of history because of horrible, horrible decisions that her husband may or may not have made based on the results of the...
Can I say two things about this? We have actually haven't discussed this, have we? We discussed it briefly on Friday because it just broke, I guess, right before Emily Rooney joined us. One, the lesson of Jussie Smollett, I think, from the same week is we should maybe wait a few days. We may know more today. And number two, I think this guy has got such goodwill in this community that the smartest thing, I'm surely not a crisis manager, instead of the statement, which I guess was necessary from his lawyers or his spokespeople the other day, if Mr. Kraft contends that he did nothing illegal, which doesn't mean he didn't do something, right. but it's not illegal, we'll have no further comment because there's pending litigation. He should have further comment.
Yes.
The answer is he is, again, this is a guy who is so huge. And I'm only talking about Greater New England. I'm not talking about the country. I don't know about the country and the NFL and his reputation there. He has such goodwill in this community and has done so many good things. By the way, totally separate from the Patriots. I don't give a damn about the fact that he's owned a successful team. That's, to me, secondary. If he did this, then the answer is he should say, I feel absolutely horrible about this. I can't, you know, if it's true, if it's true that he feels horrible about it, of course I knew about these kinds of things. I have no idea what I was thinking. I will spend the rest of my life trying to atone for this thing. I understand you may not forgive me right away, but I hope eventually you will. This is not like some career criminal who has to say, you know, this, I didn't do this, I didn't do that. Or like R. Kelly is now saying, by the way, all those women are lying. I think this is a rare case where if a guy seizes the initiative, he has the ability to survive in a lot of ways. And then the people in places that are fortunate enough to have benefited from his largesse are not going to be faced with the decision of having to forego money for things that really matter to everybody.
And you know what, Jim? I mean, you know, going off of what you're saying, and then maybe it's that he takes money and donations and puts it into programs to help women get out of the situations that they're in, whether they're in shelters because they've been abused, or the women who are looking for jobs who have not been able to get a job because they were at home raising their family or because they just didn't have the education or wherewithal to go and get a job. So maybe it's raising women up that he should focus on at this point with his philanthropy. If absolutely what you're saying is correct, that he really is sorry and this was a mistake and it was a lapse in judgment and move forward that way.
Yeah, I mean, look, he's the smart thing for him to do, Jim, is exactly what you suggested, is sort of lean into it and say, I'm really, really sorry. This is just these poor women. I didn't realize that I was, contributing to human trafficking and all that. I think his lawyer took a vast step in the wrong direction on day one. And that's a problem with when you're reacting to something like this. I would, we have to remember, yes, it's Bob Kraft. Yes, he's done an awful lot of great things for the community. These are women who weren't allowed to leave the massage parlor, at least by reports. They were required to stay there day and night. Their passports were taken. And this is not the only place in America that this happens. And so if he can use this opportunity after, by the way, doing whatever the court decides he should do to make up for it. If he uses this opportunity to elevate that issue and to really go after it and put some resources behind it, great.
But he has to get ahead
of it. First, he's got to get ahead of it.
But he really has to get ahead of it, I think.
Sam, it was awful. And in light of what the governor of Virginia did, you kind of think that maybe everyone should learn a little lesson from that, take a step back, take a breath, talk to some good PR people before saying anything.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that they point out in this story in the Globe about this was that there are more than 9,000 or more illicit massage businesses, and they make a point all across the country to run them in a standardized fashion, kind of like Starbucks. So when you go get a cafe latte at a Starbucks here or in Colorado, it's the exact same thing. They're talking about the standardization. And they also mentioned something that I found really chilling, that apparently none of the women involved in the Florida case spoke English. So, again, we don't know what happened. It will come forward. But I think in the post-Me Too movement, we see these things differently. These women didn't speak English.
I mean, by the way, let me be clear. What I'm saying, what I was saying a minute ago, doesn't mean that it's nothing at all.
Right.
It means, assuming the facts are true, as they're alleged by the cops down there, it is what it is, and he's got to figure out how to deal with it. And, you know, maybe people aren't going to be forgiving, but it seems to me that everybody, if you wait until you're cornered and then all of a sudden you decide that now I'm going to try to dig out, no one believe. We've discussed apologies on the show for the 19 years. What separates a believable, sincere apology from one that you have no choice but to give because your advisors drafted it for you for $1,000 an hour. You know, by the way, it'd be an interesting topic. Maura Healey, if you recall, was with us a couple of years ago, immediately after she and Bob Kraft, and by the way, his name is Bob, it's not Mr. Kraft, to our fellow journalists out there who refer to him as Mr. Kraft. You should be ashamed of yourself, whether you're a sports person or a regular traditional journalist. But she came in and talked to us about this joint grant. I can't remember, was it teen violence or some such thing that she, the Attorney General's office and Kraft were doing. And it'll be interesting to see what her perspective is on the collaborative work, anti-violence education program. Thank you, Amanda.
Yeah, particularly since she's spearheading across the country. Attorney General on the human trafficking.
Yes, she is.
Well, she
and
Martha Coakley, before
her, were big on this kind of thing. And I think a lot of us didn't even know this existed until recent years either.
In any case, we're talking to Jennifer Nassour and
Steve Kerrigan.
No, I know who you are. I'm just looking at my Steve Kerrigan. Thank you.
No, he just forgot who I was, so don't feel bad.
No, I actually knew.
It's like being at a family dinner.
There's some woman over there. She looks
familiar. Actually, in this case, it was some guy over here. But I actually knew who he was. I was trying to read and talk.
Okay.
We're talking to those two people.
So we're supposed to have a vote out of the House, I think it's tomorrow, on this budget resolution, which would outlaw the president's efforts to get money for his wall. Supposedly, a few Republicans are going to support it. The president has said if in some miraculous situation where everybody supports it, House and Senate, he'd veto it. But what do you think is going to happen, Steve?
I mean, it's the least, you know, secretive thing in Washington right now. It's going to pass the House just with Democratic votes. But I do think they're going to pick up some of those modern centrist sort of Republicans who are maybe in very tight districts that
Susan Collins, in Maine.
Well, that's when it gets to the Senate. Now, that's when she has a chance to prove that she's not what I think she is after the Kavanaugh vote. Then you have Murkowski and you have Collins and Cory Gardner and a few others who have spoken up a little bit against the emergency proclamation. So it's going to pass the House. Whether or not Mitch McConnell even really takes it up or allows any defections from Republicans, I don't know. In the end, it's great for us to do it. If he's going to veto it, we're never going to have veto-proof majorities in either of the votes. So it's great for us to do it from a PR perspective, I suppose. But this is going to find its way into a court pretty fast. The 16 states are already suing. It'll end up, as the president said, in the Ninth Circuit, and then we'll get a bad ruling in the Ninth Circuit. And so,
that's pretty good invitation.
Thank you very much.
But the issue is, can you explain to me, as the former chair of the Republican Party in this state, how does any Republican who has railed against usurpation of congressional authority by presidents of the United States, how do they vote for this thing? Why can't they stand up in the Senate and say, by the way, I'm totally with the president on the wall, and the reason he has to do this national emergency is because of those horrible Democrats, but I can't support him in this particular direction for precedential reasons. Why
well, I mean, you know, Jim, you have courage, and you also are not relying on taxpayer dollars to support your life. You know, these people, I think they lose their courage, a lot of them, when they get in there because they're—
Trump's going to tweet about them? Is that what they're worried about?
Well, if Trump tweets about them, then they end up being like Mia Love and not having a job anymore.
Well,
and
she's on CNN now. She's doing quite well.
I know. She's doing quite well.
She's the former congresswoman from Utah.
As she should be. But that's what you suffer. The wrath of what will happen, and your constituents don't reelect you because the president of the United States goes after you. So, I mean, I think that there's that. But Steve is totally right. It will pass in the House, and the Republicans who really need to vote along with the Democrats for their job security, and because that's what their district wants, they will vote along with them. It's never going to pass the Senate, and it's going to get vetoed by the president, and so it doesn't matter. And so it's just what the president's will is. I just wish that there were more people who would stand up and say, you know what, first of all, let's just back up a second. As a Republican, as someone who became a Republican because I believe in the fiscal part of the party, I think that any Republican who is standing up for this right now and saying we should just blow money on a wall and not take the money and use it to hire more staff, train more people at the border, and get better immigration policies and procedures in place before we build a wall. I don't disagree necessarily with doing it, but I think, you know, using all that money when we don't really have it and we have such a large deficit is going against the principles of the party. And I think that unless we start to fix it, people are always going to figure out ways to get over the wall. We have to fix immigration first.
So other than the Syria resolution, is there one thing in 2+ years Republicans have decided to pick their traditional principles over supporting the president on?
No.
I don't mean that harshly. I mean it observationally.
I think a lot of us, you know, the so-called establishment Republicans, what we fight with is what happened to the morals of our party? Where did our values go? And why is it just whatever the president dictates that it is? And so, again, not saying that any policy is right or wrong, but just saying that I think we should really, when these members of Congress are taking votes, they should really be thinking first about who elected them and the why they are in the party before they just go along with what the president says.
You know, I was just thinking that you have my total sympathy because we were talking before we went on the air about how tough it is to be a Catholic now with this disgraceful Catholic church. So you've got it coming and going.
I'm a Republican Catholic. lose situation. Oh, and I'm a woman.
Hey, before we take a break, and then we're going to talk more politics with you. This is for you. It's Steve Kerrigan, correct? I just want to be sure.
Jim, right?
So if the last time Michael Cohen came to Congress, he lied to Congress.
Yeah.
Why should the American people believe anything he says on Wednesday? And again, he's doing three hearings this week, House and Senate Intelligence, Behind Closed Doors, and the Oversight Committee, on which Steve Lynch, Ayanna Pressley, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez will be asking questions. That should be – and you'll hear it here live on 89.7. Why should we believe him anymore? He's obviously trying to sing for his own either freedom or reduced time in jail.
I don't think he's – I mean, look, for the simple reason I think he wants to be with his children when they're adults. Like, I think he lied the last time, is doing now 3.5 years in prison starting in May. And I think he's seen very clearly that Robert Mueller is not willing to – play games. If you lie to Congress and you commit a felony, we're going to send you to jail. He has cooperated a lot. That's why he's only going for 3.5 years. And so I think the way in which also the president, he lied, let's be very clear, to protect the president. The president has done nothing to protect him of late. So there's really no longer that incentive to protect him, because you can never see the possibility of Donald Trump pardoning him because he just hates the guy.
That's a hell of a tortured explanation as to why the American people believe him, though. I mean, I think that
it is,
the explanation.
But sometimes torture is, in an explanation, acceptable. That's about it.
So, I mean, Trump, obviously what Trump is going to say is what he said Wednesday morning before the hearing starts. We'll get a tweet at 6:30 in the morning saying my former occasional lawyer, which of course is not true, lied last time, and he's going to lie again today. I'm off to denuclearize North Korea. I mean, why shouldn't people buy that?
Well, 50% of the population will believe it and the other 50 won't. You know, Michael Cohen, I think we are always leery of someone who's so slimy, right, and shady as he is. And you just see it time and time again and that's why he's in the position that he's in. And he's lucky he's only going away for 3.5 years. You know, if he decides that he wants to now tell the truth in front of Congress, I would be shocked, because I'm sure that he still thinks that there's something in there for him if he behaves a little bit.
With Trump? Don't think he's burnt every single bridge with this guy?
I think that he probably thinks that there's some way to redeem himself, and he's doing the time and he's doing it on behalf of the president. I just don't trust him. I think that he's a really shady character, and anyone who's willing to go to the lengths that he was willing to go through for Trump.
Take a bullet for him, he said.
Right. He said that he's not going to lie more, he's done lying, I still hesitate to leave.
I just say that I think on Wednesday this is going to be about as interesting as opening Al Capone's vault. Like, I don't think we're going to learn anything new. I don't think we're going to learn anything new.
Do you say that in light of the fact that the whatever he talks about pre the presidency isn't covered by executive privilege? Well, it may be covered by Southern District of New York litigation, right. So maybe that prosecutor.
There's a lot still going on relative to Michael Cohen and these investigations, and I just don't think we're going to hear an awful lot new.
I hope
I'm wrong too.
We'll have Steve weigh in on whether the Mueller report is going to be like opening Al Capone's vault when we get back. We're going over the latest.
We should explain that when we get back for those who missed Geraldo's show. Why don't we explain it now?
Okay.
Geraldo built up for Geraldo Rivera for
months and months
that he was going to open Al Capone's safe live on air.
On TV.
What was in there?
Nothing.
Exactly.
Yeah, God, what a disaster. Okay, we're going over the latest headlines from the White House to State House with Steve Kerrigan and Jennifer Nassour. We're going to keep talking to them on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. If you're just tuning in, we're talking politics with Steve Kerrigan, former CEO of the Democratic National Convention. He's now head of Massachusetts Military Heroes Fund. Jennifer Nassour, former chair of the Massachusetts State GOP and now COO of Reflect Us.
Okay, so before the break, we were discussing whether all the never Trumpsters will feel like, you know, nationwide Geraldo Rivera's who pumped the big Al Capone safe, opened the safe. There was nothing there after all this excitement. You know, some people are talking about the same sort of thing happening with the Mueller report. It could be a 2-page summary of what he did and what he didn't, and ho-hum.
Yeah, I mean, it obviously could be. What I love is you could spend an entire week just reading what the Mueller report could be, stories in the news and watching them on TV. I'm going to wait to see it. I don't think we're going to see it anytime soon. I really think there's an awful lot going on out there. The House just sent over boxes and boxes of transcripts so they could see if anybody else lied. There's still a lot of moving pieces over there. My hope is that we see something substantive when we actually get to see it, if we do. But I do think the former acting Solicitor General for Obama said it best last week in some story when he said, this is the end of the beginning, you know, not the beginning of the end. And I just think it's going to be, there's a lot more to come, regardless of what's in the report.
By the way, we should say, well, the rumors, very strong rumors last week were that Mueller would deliver his report to Attorney General Barr this week. The reports over the weekend was that even wouldn't happen, right, regardless of what the thing looks like. And now Adam Schiff, chair of the House Intelligence Committee, says we have to subpoena him, we have to go to court. Whether Steve is right about timing or not, it is going to be a long time before the American people get to see virtually anything regardless, don't you think?
Yes, absolutely. So I'm going to do a couple of things. So number one, I'm going to play devil's advocate. You're just assuming, Steve, I love you, but you're just assuming that there's something out there. I mean, it is very possible that there's
a
lot of
nothing.
It's just been a very large smoke bomb. Right. And you know, ultimately it's found that Trump really wasn't involved in anything. So
you mean nothing vis-a-vis the president himself?
Correct.
Because there's a lot of people on their way to jail or in jail.
I think that Steve's comments are about finding a lot about the president, not necessarily a lot about everyone else around. So I think that's number one. Number two, Attorney General Barr has the ability to redact anything out of this document. He can summarize it and he can send it off. Once it's from Mueller to him, he could do what he wants with it. They could also keep it confidential in the House. He can do whatever he wants with it. So once the report is delivered to Barr, Barr then can take his sweet time to deliver it and to then deliver whatever portion of the report that he wants.
Yeah, that's the thing. The Mueller report being released is released to Barr. That could then be months before anybody else sees even page
one. And you know what? That's a great news dump in July, right? When they're out of session and it's quiet. Right.
So before we move away from presidential politics, Bill Weld, the former governor of Massachusetts, who ran before as a Libertarian on the undercard vice president.
Undercard.
Well, now he's saying that
in
he,
this corner.
I'm a big heavyweight champion fight fan myself. Anyway, he's saying now that he's going to enter the ring, presidential politics, establishment politician. Do you see this getting anywhere in the Republican Party?
I hope so. I mean, I think he has, and I watched his speech with great interest at the New England Council up in New Hampshire.
Were you there? Or you just saw?
No, I just watched. Okay. I watched. I was going to go up, but I didn't. You know, want to get up that early. But it was really he. I think. Represents the type of Republican. And when I went to work in the Senate back in the early 90s, those were the type of Republicans that we faced. We had ideological differences and different approaches for how you're going to govern, but you were there for the reason of helping to move our country or our Commonwealth forward. And I think Bill Weld is, first of all, got a second to none intellect, and he's whip smart, knows policy backward and forward. If he can raise some money to keep a profile up in this campaign, it'll be great. I mean, there's been polling done in New Hampshire that says that New Hampshire voters don't want to see the president challenged in a primary. Maybe they'll take a New England neighbor as an exception to that. But he's going to have to prove that he can really bring some energy and some excitement, because now you've got Larry Hogan down in Maryland thinking about doing it. Maybe we'll have another former governor of Massachusetts, Mitt Romney, decide
to do it. John Kasich.
John Kasich. I mean, there's a lot of folks, which is great, that if Weld did nothing else other than open the door to others and give them an opportunity to step up and say, yes, I'll do it, and give them a little cover, then he's already done a good service.
Yeah, Steve, before Jennifer comments on this, a lot of people think the Weld candidacy will end up being exactly like Al Capone's safe. Do you agree? Do you agree? Oh, no, that
no,
was
I have
I'm
greater,
sorry.
I have greater respect for Governor Weld than that.
Yeah. Yeah, sorry. So what do you think?
Beat that baby into the ground.
How about, I agree. I mean, I was a lobbyist in the days that Weld was, this guy, for those who weren't around either in Massachusetts or too young, he was so smart and so witty, but he got bored, as we know. He didn't leave really to become ambassador to Mexico. He left, that was the excuse because he didn't become ambassador, as people know, because he was bored to tears with the job. Sort of the opposite of his mentee, Charlie Baker, who loves the details, that kind of thing. What do you think about him as a presidential candidate?
So, I feel kind of how Steve does. Bill Weld is smart and he's charismatic and he's such an interesting character, right?
He is
great governor, and people still, even though he was governor in the 90s, people still talk about him as, their favorite governor, one of their favorite governors. So, I think having him in there is great. And I think it's great because I think it does open the door for other candidates. I think other people will say, well, if Bill Weld is doing this, then I think I should jump in here. I think his biggest problem is primary voters. Primary voters vote all the time. These are the people who pay attention. They go out, they vote, and they are not going to forget that he had left the party and then he came back.
And their primary voters are more to the right and more to the left than the average voter.
And more conservative. So his politics don't necessarily line up. And the fact that he defected and then came back for those people. Now, for the general population, I think that he becomes a more interesting candidate for those in the middle on the left and on the right, because he has that centrist.
But in some primaries like New Hampshire, those people in the middle, independents can choose their party. And that may be a window for him.
And in the New Hampshire poll, what you saw was that women and young people were more open to having someone else in the Republican primary.
You know, before we you guys leave, we only have a couple minutes left. I assume people read that this contested North Carolina congressional race was there was a 5-0 vote. So exciting to have a unanimous vote on anything. 2 Republicans in the Election Commission, 3 Democrats voted to order a new election. This comes after a hearing in which we find out that the Republican candidate lied
evangelical minister,
about
let's not forget.
A conversation he had with one of his sons about knowing about the problem. This one of his staff people creating having a shady record and allegedly then cooking absentee ballots. His son testifies against him. And we don't have time to go into all the details, but the thing I particularly wanted to ask you about, is, again, as a former Republican chair, one of the major calling cards of Republican leaders has been all this election fraud all over the country. They can never prove any of it, but there's all this election fraud. They created that phony committee with that guy from Kansas that lasted about a minute and a half, and he had, goes to New Hampshire, has no idea what the laws are in New Hampshire, but speaks about them anyway. I mean this sincerely, Jennifer. How do the Republican leaders talk about election fraud in the same way they have in the past when the highest profile proven case of election fraud is one of their own?
I it's very difficult. It makes it a very difficult road to go down when you see it happening. And he lied. And I think more
his lawyer had to out him, by the way. Yeah. That's how this ended. His lawyer is not going to essentially cover up for perjury by his client.
Right. And it's also, I think, the biggest point to be made here is do not piss off your adult children.
Exactly. Wow. Yeah, the son threw him
right under the bus.
It was incredible. The
but
dynamics
good for
in
yeah,
that
good
family.
For them, yeah.
Where's mom? Do we know?
Well,
is mom with her husband or with her kid?
Clearly
I don't
she
know.
Raised her kids right.
Yeah, seriously.
It's a great story. Okay. Thank
nice
you very
you
much,
both.
You guys.
Thanks
great to see you.
Thanks for having me.
Jennifer Nassour is the former chairman of the Mass GOP and COO of Reflect Us. Steve Kerrigan is president and co-founder of the Massachusetts Military Heroes Fund, former CEO of the DNC. Jennifer and Steve, thank you so much for coming in. Coming up, in Venezuela, protests are breaking out on the border of the country's bracing for an aid showdown. U.S. lawmakers are divided on what to do. And actually, we have some great news about on-the-ground journalism, too, that Charlie Sennett is going to tell us about. He's up next from the Ground Truth Project on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marj Regan. After last year's summit with Kim Jong-un, the president tweeted, there is no longer a nuclear threat from North Korea. More recently, during the State of the Union address, the president said that North Korea had stopped nuclear testing. But on the eve of a second summit beginning later this week with Kim Jong-un, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo offered a different analysis on CNN, saying that North Korea is, in fact, it is a nuclear threat as we speak. So what are the White House's expectations for North Korea heading into another round of negotiations? Joining us for his take on this, Trump reversing his decision to pull troops out of Syria and other global headlines is Charlie Sennett. Charlie's a news analyst here at GBH. He also heads up the Ground Truth Project, calling us from, I believe, Miami. Hey there, Charlie.
Hey, Jim. Hey, Marjorie.
Hey, Charlie, we are going to talk about why you're in Miami in about 2 seconds, but I want to preface it by saying every time I get a chance to be on a soapbox, I talk about how people are going to be very, very sorry about the demise of their local newspapers because, and recent research has backed this up, that when there's no one there to watch what goes on in your local town, i.e. reporters, terrible things happened. Fraud and corruption happened. So that's why I was ecstatic to learn that you just got a $5 million commitment from the Knight Foundation to report for America. Tell people what you're doing.
Sure. So the Ground Truth Project launched Report for America in like the fall of 2017. We've talked about it before, but it's so last year, 2018, we had 13 reporters and newsrooms all over the country embedded into local communities, and it's sort of like Teach for America for journalism. It's a call to service to say local news is in a big crisis and we need more ground truth out there in these local communities. So we've developed this project, and Knight has just been extraordinary. The Knight Foundation stepped in. This is a $300 million overall commitment to sort of restoring, rejuvenating. rejuvenating local news, and we're really proud to have a piece of that. It sounds like a ton of money, like a huge Marshall Project for local reporting, and it is, but the wild news is that it's nowhere near enough. The death of journalism in our country is happening like every day. Jobs are falling off the map. In our town, Boston, we're lucky. We have GBH, we have the Globe, we have strong local news, but many cities, particularly rural areas and sort of other, you know, like urban areas around the country are real news deserts. And so Knight is trying to do something about that, and Report for America is our effort to put an oar in the water and try to really do something to get more young people out there. So this year we're going to put 60 reporters into newsrooms. And we're on track next year to do 250 reporters through
wow.
Report for America.
So, Charlie, if people who are listening would like to be one of those 60 or 250, what do they do? Where do they get more information?
Well, they can go to thegroundtruthproject.org, or even easier, they can just go to reportforamerica.org and take a look. We closed our application process for the 60 for this year, but we are going to be expanding, and I really want, you know, particularly young people listening to know that, you know, this is a great calling, and that I don't think everyone in Boston realizes how lucky we are sometimes to have this strong local news traditions. There's a real need across the country, places like Mississippi, Appalachia, Ohio, Pennsylvania, the border areas, where we're just flooding the zone. And I'd love people to really think of it as a calling. And it's all built around this idea of ground truth. So thanks for asking. And it would be to go to reportforamerica.org is where they can find out more about it.
You know, Charlie, just one last thing about this. Even here, though, I mean, I said this to you before. When I was first a reporter, I used to cover all these boring, supposedly little town meetings, these little suburbs. But zoning boards of appeals, even in the tiniest suburbs, they make, or tiny little towns that aren't even suburbs, they make huge decisions about having development and money, and big millions of dollars can change hands. And if no one is watching this, all sorts of corruption can go on. And I think even here in Massachusetts, we don't have the Taunton Gazette with its full flank of reporters. We don't have the Fall River Herald News. We don't have the Dighton Reporter, all these places that go out and cover this stuff. So that's why what you're doing is so, so important. And people trash the media all the time, this, that. Well, the media is what keeps government honest. And when there's no one doing it in small towns, I think things go south really quickly.
That's exactly right. And, you know, one last point, and I know we got to get talking about the world, but the idea is that we need these local eyes on the ground to keep government honest. We also know
exactly.
that, like, literally, bond ratings for towns and counties that have good, thriving newspapers are much higher.
Yeah.
They're literally metrics to judge the value of a great local newspaper to a community. And the reality here is that the commercial models, the for-profit models, are really struggling. In the digital age, it's really hard. We all know this story. It's very, very hard for traditional newspapers to make it work. And the nonprofit sector, like the Knight Foundation and other big foundations, really need to step in. And in the case of Knight, they are stepping in. And I think this is a really exciting area around rejuvenating news, which is something GBH has been doing for a very long time and is a real standard bearer on, but that's community support and really thinking about public media and thinking about how the nonprofit role is going to be huge in the future of journalism.
Charlie, congratulations to you and congratulations to them. We're going to put you on hold for a second, but now the clicking sound has disappeared on the call. Are you still there?
I am. Sorry, can you hear me? Okay.
Yeah. Is that fixable, ladies and gentlemen, or is that... We're working on it right now. Okay. So, Charlie, North Korea talks, I guess, I don't know how else to describe them, in Hanoi are to begin mid this week. As I said in the introduction to you, Donald Trump's explanation of where things are on the North Korea front is not the same as even loyalists like the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, say. So in light of that, and in light of increasing numbers of reports that say denuclearization is not something that Kim Jong-un is taking very seriously, what are realistic expectations for these couple of days of summit?
You know, there's an incredible metaphor I was thinking about this morning. You've got Kim Jong-un on a slow train, lead-lined and protected, on a slow ride from North Korea through China to Vietnam. And you've got Trump tweeting about the Oscars. And it just sort of says everything about
Spike Lee in particular. Go ahead, I'm sorry, yeah.
Just between the expectations going into this. You know, one is this slow, deliberate move through a region that's volatile on their home turf. And it is resonant, I think, for a lot of Americans that it's in Vietnam, you know, a former adversary. So it's both hopeful we can turn things around and have working relationships with countries where we once had a conflict. Vietnam's a great example of that. Hopefully North Korea will be. But the greatest expectation I think we can have for this is that we actually get an end of conflict agreement and we actually get some symbolic steps forward. And that'll be good for everyone. And I don't think anyone can criticize the Trump administration for trying to do that. The worry that's expressed within his own security team is that North Korea is not living up even to the kind words that were professed around denuclearization. And there's a complete disconnect on what that means. And that brings us back to where we were. And I just would remind everyone, we're in such a vicious news cycle all the time. We forget how things get started. The only crisis with North Korea, the real crisis, was started by Trump himself with really dramatic rhetoric, remember, around his button is bigger, around the saber rattling he did with North Korea. That was fearful, and we're in a much better place now. Talking is always better than any move toward hostility. But I don't want to, like, I have a real problem with the fact that we need, as journalists, to be the ones who frame the history of this and look at it in context. And I think that context matters. Trump created a crisis that he's now on a road, hopefully, to bringing down to a much lower temperature. But is there anything substantive that will come on the denuclearization front? There are a lot of skeptics in his own security team about that. I think the hope we can have is that there will be something symbolic, and that matters.
You know, one last thing on this, though. In light of the fact Kim Jong-un is not a dope, and the experience from the first summit is he knows he gave up very little, and the president trumpeted it as a much bigger deal than it was, why isn't that the instructive moment for him to say, I don't have to give up anything again, because knowing Donald Trump, he's going to say it was a great success regardless. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I think it's a great question. I think it's inside the question is an insight, which is this is, like all diplomacy, it is absolutely a game of who has the advantage, and home turf matters, deeper understandings of complex issues matter. Trump comes into this with neither of those. He doesn't have the home court, that's for sure, and he also doesn't seem to have a complex understanding of the issues, and those on his team that do, he doesn't listen to them. So I think there's a reason for concern that we're hearing from inside this administration that this is worrisome. But I think no one wants to be so cynical as to think that we shouldn't at least give some diplomatic breakthrough a chance. I think we want to do that. Just not convinced we're going to see it, because I don't think President Trump is fully briefed on the complexity of the issues, and I don't think the real heart of this is in a very much different place than it has been before. Denuclearization is something that Kim Jong-un will not give up easily. Every person who knows the region keeps saying that to the Trump administration. I just hope that we don't have any significant mistakes here. And I don't think that will happen. As I say, I think this is really about symbolism. And in diplomacy, symbolism really does matter.
We're talking to Charlie Sennett from the Ground Truth Project.
So, Charlie, give us the update on Venezuela. There seems to be a little bit of a split between Republicans.
I'm sorry.
Oh, you mean the government down there?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, there's a big split down there. I think we know that. But our response to it, Republicans have been pretty united. There seems to be some concern, particularly Bernie Sanders voicing concern about what the United States is going to do about this upset over the Maduro regime.
Yeah, I think this weekend was critical. The clashes along the Colombian border are very significant, and it really puts on the line. Which way is this going to go? Is the military in Venezuela going to side with the future of Venezuela and the hopes of the opposition, or is it going to get in line with Maduro and with the dictatorship, I think it's fair to call it that, that runs the country? And the international community has to ask itself a question. If it's going to intervene, what does that mean? We've talked before about this real haunting overlay of past U.S. experience in Latin America that informs this moment for many people in the region. They don't love the U.S. when it starts to meddle inside of Latin America. We have a pretty terrible track record for that. Yet, we have to also look at the reality that this is truly a humanitarian crisis. I believe the number is 3 million Venezuelans who have left their country. That's 10% of the country. That's like the equivalent to about 35 or more million Americans leaving. Imagine that level of crisis inside your country. There's hunger, there's poverty, there's chaos, and there's an autocratic dictator who's trying desperately to hold on to power. And the international community will have to ask itself, is there a role for them to play here in upholding order and trying to preserve freedom for people, essentially? And I think that is that's a question that's very dramatic, unfolding in real time. And the issue on the border with the clashes, I think, was the first glimpse of this coming to a head.
And by the way, for those who didn't follow it this weekend, the so-called clashes on the border, including the Maduro government setting fire to millions and millions of dollars of humanitarian aid intended for his people. You know, the best piece, Charlie, the New York Times done unbelievable reporting on this whole Venezuela situation. There was a piece the other day, I just looked it up, a staggering exodus. Millions of Venezuelans are leaving the country on foot. It is really painful. And, you know, this is one of the issues where I hope people who are not fans of Donald Trump can realize he seems to be on the right side.
Yes.
The issue is not who's on the side of a more democratic, freer, more economically sane Venezuela, but how do you get there? And I think what the Sanders of the world, who seem to be the outliers here, as in Bernie, are saying is our interventionist policies, particularly invasion, have not ended up so well. So the question is, how do you do this without that sort of action on the part of the United States? But there seems to be some amount of unity that this is a problem that demands attention, I guess.
Yeah, and I think there are key countries here, Spain among them, that always play a very important role inside of Latin America in relation to how the U.S. is going to deal with this. And I think, I really do think there's a way to thread the needle here and for the aid to get through. I mean, that's the first step here, right? So you literally had the Maduro government violently blocking foreign aid convoys on the border between Venezuela and Colombia over the weekend. Protesters were killed. I believe there were two deaths. And, you know, now Juan Guaido, who's the opposition leader, is really asking for the U.S. and for the world to consider, as he put it, all options to try to force Maduro out. So this is a situation that's really heating up. I think the hope, the best hope for Venezuela and for the future of that country and its people, will be if the military sides with the opposition and decides that there really does need to be a change of regime. And that is literally twisting in the wind right now, and we're going to see where it goes.
Charlie Sennett, there's a story in the New York Times about this Alabama woman who joined ISIS, and President Trump says she can't come back here. There's a dispute about her passport, whether she was born, when her father was a diplomat or not. But I wanted to talk.
You should just say, I didn't know until this morning. If you're born here, you're a citizen. The one exception is if your parents were diplomats.
Active diplomat,
right, yeah.
And supposedly she was born 1 month after her father was left the diplomatic service. But what I wanted to talk to you is a bigger picture on these women who, knowing full well what ISIS was doing, a lot of them were young, teenagers, 16, 17. This particular woman they're talking about is 20 years old. She was a student in Alabama at the time she left to go to Turkey. But, you know, these are pretty – what happens to them in the criminal justice system? It seems to me these are crimes against the United States of America, and that there has to be some adjudication of those people who do get back here.
Yeah, this is a tough one. I mean, it's a very complex and tangled set of legal issues, and I think the it certainly made sense to me that the United States would want to bring her back with the understanding you're going to be prosecuted. You know,
yeah.
Like when you come back, you're facing the full force of the law because you broke the law and an act of treason against this country that you proclaim to be your own, and you're going to pay for that crime. I would think they would accept that. But for some reason, they're saying, do not let her back into the country. And I don't quite think that's going to be legal. And I
yeah.
don't think it's very well thought through. And I bet it changes. It feels to me like a tweet from the president that will, like, go away, like the fever that passes with almost every issue he comments on, including Syria, right? We're taking all the troops out of Syria. Now, you know, sort of a rational argument to keeping a few hundred in is taking shape. I think similarly with this, there'll be some rational policy that yields once the fever of the Trump tweets subsides and we get back to dealing with reality, because it makes sense. Another thing on this story that I was really interested in is this is so interesting to me because I covered it on the ground, and this is literally local reporting ground truth. I was a police reporter in New York when the first World Trade Center bombing happened. And this woman was born right in the middle of all of that. Remember, it's February of 93. I think she's born just after that, like literally 10 months after. And Yemen was very much in play in the hard news stories we were investigating, like cop reporters trying to figure out who would blow up the World Trade Center, who'd want to try to take down the World Trade Center.
Right.
Remember, this is 93, before 9/11, 8 years before. And Yemen was right at the center of that, and the UN diplomats connected to Yemen at that time were very much being questioned about their role, because it was very, very much at the heart of the cell that was forming that did the first World Trade Center bombings. I am hugely interested in going back to my notes and seeing if this family, this father...
Well, he was a Yemeni... Yeah, we didn't say that.
Figured.
He was a diplomat from Yemen. We should have said that.
From Yemen. And
yeah.
Yemen was right at the heart of those early, early police reporting days. And when I remember the city editor at the Daily News asked me, as a local cop reporter in New York, who'd want to blow up the World Trade Center? Let's go figure that out. And I swear to God, these threads, you know, so all these years later are there.
Yeah, well, she was...
And I have to go back full circle to local reporting, right?
She'd be 24 or 25. 25 then, yeah. Something like that, if she was born then. Anyway, Charlie Sennett, thank
you
very
much. Good to talk
to you,
Charlie. Congratulations yet again.
Yeah.
Thanks, Jim.
Yeah.
Thanks, Marjorie.
Thank you. Charlie Sennett joins us every week. He's a news analyst here at WGBH, where he also heads up the Ground Truth Project. Up next... Roger McNamee, a tech advisor and one-time mentor to Mark Zuckerberg. He knew Zuckerberg way back at the beginning. He's now, that is McNamee, facing up to the evils of Facebook. It's the subject of his new book, Zucked. That is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, when Facebook was a startup, their motto, Move Fast and Break Things, was in the spirit of their anti-establishment culture. Today, Move Fast and Break Things has a different meaning, from its invasive surveillance, reckless sharing of data, and algorithms that helped to influence the 2016 election. At noon, we talked to Roger McNamee, an early booster of Facebook and mentor of Mark Zuckerberg, who's now sounding the alarm on the company he helped build. It's the subject of his new book, Zucked. Comedian Jane Lynch, travel guru Rick Steves, and Bernadette Peters will all walk into Symphony Hall. Today, Keith Lockhart joins us to preview the Boston Pops 2019 spring season.
With the United Methodist Church split in two over LGBT issues, Reverend Zion Monroe and Emmett Price join us for all that on All Revved Up. This year's Oscars was fraught with controversy months before last night's broadcast. We'll ask TV's Bob Thompson if the Academy overcame those concerns to pull off a worthy show.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
Houston Brady, I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Good morning, Jim.
Hello again, Marjorie. How are you? So tech investor Roger McNamee was a booster of Facebook and an early advisor to Mark Zuckerberg when it was a Silicon Valley startup with aspirations to connect the world. Now that it's dominating the world, McNamee is sounding the alarm on the tech giant he helped build. It's the subject of his new book. It's called Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe. Roger is the founding partner of the venture capital firm Elevation Partners and a classmate, we should say, of Shannon O'Brien's at Yale, which is the most important thing. Roger, it's great to see you. Thanks for being here.
Jim, what a pleasure to be here.
Oh, we're thrilled. We're thrilled to talk to you. Before we get to your thesis about Facebook being an existential threat to democracy and health and privacy in the economy, which is pretty upsetting, I've never met anybody that knew Mark Zuckerberg when he was 22 years old. You did.
I did.
And yeah.
My experience with Mark when he was young was uniformly fantastic. Now, I only knew him in a work setting. But if you're trying to advise or mentor a young person, the thing you notice is whether they respond or not to the input that you give them. And Mark uniformly embraced the counsel that I gave because he asked me for things where he was open and ready to get advice. And the thing that has been most distressing about the experience of the last 3 years is that openness is no longer there. The goal of self-improvement and learning from the experience of others, at least learning from me, was no longer there. So I would have to say that it was a very different experience than the one I knew from 2006.
Can we stay with that just for a second? We had Jesse Eisenberg in here about a year ago. When he remember those short stories
he
wrote
that
were fabulous.
He's really talented.
Jesse Eisenberg is the only Mark Zuckerberg we know. Was he a respectful young kid? How did he interact with you?
So the first time I met him was the most unusual meeting I've ever had in my entire professional life because he comes in a meeting that was hastily arranged. Apparently there was a crisis in the company. I was not told what it was. I was just saying, would you please meet with my boss? And so I did. And I said, listen, Mark, before you say anything, I need to give you 2 minutes of background because I have a very strong point of view here. The company was 2 years old, and it was only $9 million in revenues the prior year, basically ads for pizza delivery. I mean, it was not the Facebook we know today. It was still just a picture and a personal address. There was no news feed. In fact, it was just students still. And I said, if it hasn't already happened, either Microsoft or Yahoo is going to offer $1 billion for Facebook. And everybody, you know, your parents, your board of directors, your management team, they're all going to tell you, take the money. I mean, the company had 9 million revenues, right? There's no way they're going to say no. And I said, listen, honest to God, man, if you believe your vision, you got to follow it through because you have found the holy grail for building a large network. You have true, authenticated identity, which gets rid of trolls, and you have absolute privacy controls, and that makes people trust you. I said, those two things are the things that MySpace and Friendster and all that lacked, and I think it's a really big...
But those are the two reasons why you were convinced early on that this was going to be the biggest thing ever.
And I think if he had stuck with those things, the problems we're dealing with today would never have emerged.
You know what's amazing? As I'm reading your book, by the way, about the $1 billion offer and you talking about in advance out of it before you even knew it had happened, even though you assumed it had happened, I'm watching, what's the name of the CNN tech reporter? I'm watching Facebook at 15, Lori Siegel, I think her name is, and literally they're talking about that moment. The moment you talked him out of is maybe the pivotal moment in Facebook's young history.
To be clear, he didn't want to sell the company. He just was afraid to say no to all these really important people in his life. And what I did was help him find a path through the problem. But the reason it was so weird, the reason the meeting was so weird was that I say this to him, and you have to imagine the scene. I'm in a room that's like a recording studio. It's in our offices. We thought at Elevation we were going to be a big deal in the video game industry, and so we had a room configured with a giant stereo and huge TV and all these video game consoles, and so it had to be deadened and soundproofed in order to be in an office. And I finished laying this big idea on him. Right, and I don't know whether it's accurate or not, and I'm expecting a response. But what I get instead is almost 5 minutes of dead silence while he's trying to decide whether or not he trusts me. And you know what 10 seconds of dead air is like when you're looking somebody in the eye expecting a response. Almost 5 minutes. I mean, I was dying. And, you know, I relay the story in the book because it was, you know, it really was so unusual. At the beginning, I think he's just being incredibly respectful. He's thinking through it. And then after a minute or so, I'm thinking, this is really weird. And after 2 minutes, I'm, you know, anxious. At 3 minutes, I'm dying. At 4 minutes, I'm ready to scream. And, you can imagine, right? But what was interesting is that I had spent my life dealing with technology entrepreneurs. And as a class, they're really intense. And they're not always socially comfortable.
Yes. Well, you talk about that a lot.
That wasn't so weird, right? I mean, I'm not the most socially comfortable person either, and so it didn't feel that strange. 5 minutes, honest to God, was nuts. But other than that, everything about the meeting was great.
But you question his ability to empathize.
Well, that was something that was less obvious at the time, but. You know, in retrospect, it's very clearly an issue. And it's something that if you met Jesse Eisenberg, it's something that they get to in The Social Network, which was a big clue. Now, I didn't go watch the movie. And I didn't watch it because I wanted to believe that the Mark I knew was the new Mark, that he had grown up. And
yeah.
That, you know, he was only 22 when I met him. And the movie takes place almost 2 years before that. And, you know, so it's entirely possible that he could have had growth experiences that matured, and it's also possible that he didn't.
But we should make clear, for those who haven't read the book yet, this meeting, this first meeting when Zuckerberg's 22, was not a one and done. You talked to him or saw him regularly for years. Sometimes several times a day, right?
No. So what happened afterwards was that he called me up a couple days later, invited me to come visit. And from that point forward, I was an advisor who would see him anywhere from once a month to a couple times a week. And I was dealing with a very specific set of issues, but you can imagine the situation. Once he decided that it was okay to tell everybody he wasn't going to sell the company, then the people who told him you have to sell the company that were part of his management team had to go. So I helped him swap out a whole bunch of people in the team.
And you got him Sheryl Sandberg, too. I mean,
well, that was just fortuitous because at the time, my business partner was Bono from U2. And Sheryl had introduced me to Bono back in roughly 2000. And so when she told me she was going to leave Google, I said, hey, you got to go look at Facebook. And her reaction was, he's 23. And I said to Mark, you got to go look at Sheryl Sandberg. And he goes, she's at Google. And I'm going, come on, you guys. This is like, it's not that complicated. There's nothing closer to Facebook than Google. And yeah, he's 23, but his mother's a physician. And he has nothing but sisters. He's going to be cool with a woman. Both of those things turned out to be true.
It's unbelievable. And Marjorie, you and I travel in the exact same circles.
Yeah, we do.
And we've
never met
with Bono and Zuckerberg and Sam. One more thing before we get to...
You didn't live in California either.
Before we get to the alarm bells and what caused you to have this epiphany, if you want to call it that. You also one of the first meetings with someone we all know, Jeff Bezos. What was Bezos like in that thing?
To be clear, my business at that time, which would have been 1994 or 95, was inside Kleiner Perkins, Caulfield and Byers, which was, you know, the headquarters of the internet, you know, from the mid-90s. And when Jeff came in the first time, he was so I'm just a participant, right? This isn't actually my meeting. I'm just there. And I didn't always get to go into first meetings at Kleiner Perkins, but for whatever reason, I got to go into that one. And he was the most unusual person. He had all the intensity that Zuckerberg had, but he had this sense of humor and a goofy laugh. And so he had this, his intensity was buffered by a sense of humor and an obvious breadth of knowledge and experience that were really unusual. In fact, you look back at him now, and you know, he is in a league entirely by himself. Of all of the people I've been able to work with over the years, whether it was, you know, Gordon Moore, Steve Jobs, or Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos is, he's truly one of a kind. And, you know, his intellect is obviously enormous. His ability to look at things both strategically and tactically is, I've never seen anybody with the analytical skills that he has.
Except when it comes to texting. That's the one place where he has a
well,
little,
you know, which
a little bit of
I would simply observe that may be the fact that he has an emotional spectrum that was above average in that world, that, you know, he is a person who can get lost in his emotions, which many of these other people could not. And that, you know, like I said, I think in many ways that is an endearing aspect of Jeff, not a disturbing aspect.
That's Roger, you know, McNamee's book is Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe.
You know, before we do move off these people, I know obviously you didn't have a close relationship with all of them, but can you draw some general conclusions about the Steve Jobs, the Bill Gates?
You mean the common thread kinds of things?
Yeah, Jeff Bezos. Obviously, they've got big brains, but beyond that?
Well, to me, the thing that really distinguished all of them, and, you know, I really start with Gordon Moore at Intel, who's Moore's Law and all of that, is that they had an insight about the world, that they saw something that they believed they could bring about. And through thick and thin, and keep in mind, with the exception of Mark, all these people had to spend years bringing their vision to life. They stayed focused on it. They surrounded themselves with people who had the skills that they lacked. And that's the thing that's really amazing when you think about Gordon Moore, when you think about Steve Jobs, when you think about Bill Gates, are the people that they surrounded themselves with and how incredibly talented they were. And, you know, like when I think about Steve Jobs, I think, you know, Steve was mercurial, and he could be such a pain in the rear end. I mean, oh my God,
he just read his daughter's book,
and oh, I mean, that story is just
devastating.
Awful. And at the same time, you know, he did amazingly good things, you know, in terms of not just the products that were created, but the value system of Apple today, you know, started from him. You know, that the sort of hippie positive notion and this absolute commitment to protecting the people who are the customers, you know, of trying to actually be good. I mean, the thing that's lacking right now in Silicon Valley is a sense of responsibility. And Steve brought that, and Tim Cook has taken that to a new level, you know. And, you know, when I think through the history of Silicon Valley, the challenge today is that it went from an idealism that was untempered by any sense of responsibility to one that has had a sense of responsibility to one that is untempered.
So can you, Roger McNamee, we're most concerned about solutions, and you propose some, but we have to do the middle ground here. What were the things that tipped you off in 2016 that the promise of Facebook was, let's say, souring? There were a couple of things.
So I had stopped being involved in 2009. So in 2016, I'd been away from it and a cheerleader, and, you know, mm-hmm. it had really worked out great, and I was so immensely proud of it, and quite candidly suffered a failure of analysis for a bunch of years. There had been signals along the way that not everything was right in the kingdom. In 2016, my wife Ann and I were on vacation, and I was on Facebook as I would be every day because I'm a hopeless addict to technology. And I saw originally in the New Hampshire primary images depicting Hillary Clinton that were extremely misogynistic and supposedly coming from Facebook groups affiliated with the Bernie Sanders campaign. And they were obviously not something a campaign would do. So this was some group that just positioned itself as being about Bernie Sanders. But it spread virally. So the first day I saw one friend having it, then maybe the next day there were three or four, and then after that maybe eight. You know, it grew in a way that made me think, oh my gosh, whoever's running this group is paying money to get people into it, which didn't make any sense if you're spreading misogynistic things. You're just, why would you spend money to do that? The second thing I saw was that Facebook expelled a group that was using the advertising tools to gather information about people who expressed an interest in Black Lives Matter. And they were selling the information to police departments, which was deeply evil. And obviously Facebook hadn't done that, and they did the right thing. They expelled the group, but the harm had been done. And I realized, oh my gosh, you know, bad actors can use these tools in ways they were never intended, do great harm, and there's nothing you're going to be able to do about it until it's too late. Then came Brexit, the UK referendum on leaving the European Union. And on that one, that was the first time I realized, wow, you can use Facebook's advertising tools. And if your message is really inflammatory, it's going to confer an advantage in a democratic election. And I mean, that's a bad thing. If you can't have a neutral, stable message get through, if it's going to be outvoted, we're toast, right?
And you include in your appendix at the end the entire letter that you wrote to Sheryl yeah. Sandberg and Mark Zuckerberg in October before the election, detailing your concerns.
So what happened was the fourth thing that happened was the Housing and Urban Development citing the Facebook for advertising tools that allowed discrimination in housing. And so I have two civil rights things, two things related to electoral politics, neither of which was related to the presidential election. And so when I went to them, it was very explicitly with this notion there was something wrong with the business model and the algorithms that allowed bad actors to harm innocent people. It never occurred to me it was going to affect the election. And so when I went to them, I sent them this op-ed that I wrote for a technology blog. And so it's a bit emotional. When you read it, you'll see that it, in retrospect, I probably should have rewritten it for them, but I was in a hurry, so I sent it to them. And they got back. They were incredibly polite, but totally dismissive. They treated it like a public relations problem, not like a business problem. And then after the election, I spent 3 months begging them to do what Johnson & Johnson had done after the Tylenol
poison. Tell people what Johnson & Johnson did.
So in 1983, somebody put poison in a handful of bottles of Tylenol in Chicago and killed a few people. And Johnson & Johnson immediately withdrew every bottle of Tylenol from every retail shelf in every store in the United States of America and kept them off the shelves until they had invented and were able to implement tamper-proof packaging. It was one of those anecdotes that has redefined brand management, because while Johnson & Johnson was not responsible for the poison, they took responsibility for the safety of the customers of the product. And I went to Facebook and I'm going, guys, you didn't do this. But what happened to Johnson & Johnson was they built brand equity. They spent money and there was a cost, but in the end, they were better off. And I said, guys, you just need to make sure that you don't lose trust here, because if people decide you're responsible, the fact that the law says you're a platform, not a media company, that's not going to work if people decide that you're responsible for harming innocent people because people are using your tools, because your products effectively weren't designed with safety in mind.
So why don't they fix themselves? I mean, I remember the Tylenol incident, and I remember at that time saying, I'm never going to use Tylenol again. But we talked every time there's a crisis, which is almost every day with Facebook vis-a-vis privacy, and we open the line to the callers, virtually everybody says it's the nature of the beast in 2019. Is it because they don't suffer the same sort of loss of customer base that they decide to just ignore advice like yours and recommendations from well-intentioned people?
So I don't want to guess why they're behaving the way they are, other than to note that for the at least 5 years before I reached out to them, every time a critic had come forward, Facebook had prevailed, and they'd gotten used to this notion that critics were always wrong. And so I think that was a piece of it. I think what's, to me, the part that's really makes me angry is that I believe it's possible that what happened in 2016 was really the result of well-intended strategies producing, you know, unintended consequences, and that anybody can make a mistake. What really makes me angry is that once the evidence came out, the fact that they're still denying and deflecting and dissembling is really, in my opinion, just horrible. And, you know, they're taking a bad situation, making it much worse, risking the whole business, risking everybody's jobs, and risking the health of the people who use the product, democracy, privacy, and the big parts of the entrepreneurial economy. And they're doing this for reasons that, you know, no objective person could justify. I mean, you look at it, it's nuts.
To make more money.
Or just to be more powerful, right? To just get their way, I think, is more likely.
So what's the McNamee solution? You lay out in your last couple of chapters. Well,
so what I would advise everybody is to recognize that Facebook is not the only problem. Google is, in many ways, going forward, a much bigger problem than Facebook. Facebook, though, has the ability to manipulate people to degrees that we don't see at Google. But Google knows more about us, has more products, more control, and they're taking it into places that, that are going to affect our lives much more profoundly.
So what do we do?
Artificial intelligence.
What's the name of that woman? Is it Kashmir Hill, who got off, attempted to get off all five?
Yeah, she wrote a story about how impossible it was.
Gizmodo or whatever.
No, it's really – I have gotten off – so I have I turned getting off of Google into a video game. I call it – it's like Frogger, right? So I'm the Frogger. Google is the river. The other products that I use instead are the logs. And every once in a while, I'll inadvertently hit a map, you know, in a restaurant thing online and wind up in Google Maps, fall into the river and have to start again. But my high score is 2 months. So if you make it into a video game, that really helps.
So what do we do?
So the most important, what I really wanted to do is make sure everybody understands what the problem is. So the problem here is not that they're getting your data, right? Because everybody's data is already out there. You say, you know, big deal. I'm not doing anything wrong. The problem here is that the data that they gather, they're not gathering to make the product better for you. They're gathering in order to control large populations. The Harvard scholar Shoshana Zuboff calls this a behavioral surplus. And what they do with this is they essentially created a futures market in human behavior. And in Facebook's case, they can take that, and because their product is so addictive and so easy to manipulate people's attention, they can actually make some of the predictions come true. And this notion is basically human behavior is now a commodity that you've lost control of. It doesn't matter whether you're using the products or not. Everybody's life is now being managed by these systems because essentially marketers are making these increasingly accurate bets using artificial intelligence, using all of the data that they're gathering, not just online. They're also getting your credit card information. They're getting all your location data from your cellular company. And now we are discovering, you know, today and yesterday that they're getting health information from apps that you thought were private. And they're gathering all this stuff not to make products better for you, but to rather to manipulate our lives. And you say to yourself, Roger, that's unbelievable. And my point is, yes, it's unbelievable, but unfortunately, it is a fact.
So what do we do?
So I believe we have to have legal changes, okay? It's not enough to change your own behavior. I think changing your own behavior is super helpful. But we have to ask questions. Why is it legal for companies to gather and sell our personal financial transaction data? Why is credit card data available freely in the marketplace?
I can answer that one, because Congress are a bunch of weaklings who will never stand up to any big corporate interests. Is that the right answer?
I disagree with that conclusion, but I'm testing that hypothesis now. I actually believe Congress will stand up on this issue.
Because of the new kids on the block.
Not just because of the new kids on the block. I actually think let me get to that in 10 seconds. So I want to run through the list. So health information. Why is health information freely available? Why is anybody allowed to say we own this data, right? They've essentially acted as though it's an eminent domain opportunity for them, and they own it. And so, and how about geolocation data from your cellular carrier? I mean, with health, geolocation, and finance, you can get an almost, I mean, a really high-resolution picture of anybody. And if you have a high-resolution picture and your AI covers enough apps in people's lives, like mortgages, like jobs and all that, you can actually influence people's lives and they will never be aware of it. And so I think you have to stop it. You have to stop all data gathering on minors, on kids under 18. I mean, so I basically want to cut off the ability of the data economy to assert ownership. And if we end the practice of trading and using financial, health, location, and kid data, then we can have a reasonable conversation about what should be legitimate.
But that's dependent on a responsible Congress, is it not? All those changes you talked about?
Or responsible states. So we're going this way in California. You have to pierce the terms of service right now, force people to arbitration to settle disputes, and California's got a proposal to change the law to allow litigation. That's really important for changing incentives, because right now there are no consequences. If you get a $1 billion fine from some agency every 5 years, that's just the cost of doing business. Right. We have to make it $20 to $30 billion a year coming from 100 different cases or 1,000 different cases, because right now these people believe that they are exceptional and that they're always right. And what they're doing very dishonestly. They're pretending as though Google uses the term, it's digital exhaust, like it's a waste product. And in fact, it's not. What it is it's your life, it's your behavior. And whether you're on the systems or not, they are manipulating you. And we have to stop pretending that these guys are forces for good.
Okay, so we have a minute left. Are you hopeful kind of guy, or you're
very,
not?
Very.
Give us a minute on why.
Because I believe the
Because we want to be too, by the way.
Yeah. No, so I first of all, the audiences that are turning out to my events are huge. They're passionate. They want to be involved. They are willing to change their behavior. They are willing to make this the issue of 2020, because this is really low-hanging fruit. There are 100,000 employees at Google. There are 30,000 at Facebook, and the rest of us have a lot more votes, okay? In Congress, we've just elected 40 people whose average age is 40 years old, in spite of Donna Shalala, who brings it up all by herself.
And, from Miami, for those who haven't paid attention.
But these are digital native people. On top of that, the California delegation, the Bay Area delegation that represents these guys, are all absolutely on top of this. They're incredibly brave. I'm less comfortable with our senators in California, but
Nancy Pelosi.
She's wonderful on this.
She
issue.
Is because yeah. she's involved with. She's money in Facebook, doesn't she?
I have no idea.
But Kamala Harris, you are worried about?
She hasn't shown the openness on these issues that I would hope for, but there's time, right? I mean, my point is, I'm right now pleading with her to get on top of this issue. But if you look at Jackie Spear, who has Facebook and YouTube, if you look at Anna Eshoo, who has Google, they are at the forefront of this stuff, and that's incredibly brave in both cases. So I think Congress will get there. I think states will get there. Maura Healey here in Massachusetts, I mean, she's unbelievably good, and we just need to get some things through your legislature. You need a privacy law that, you know, ends the trading in these kinds of things. And it shouldn't be a right versus left issue. This is a right versus wrong issue.
Maura Healey's with us tomorrow. We'll pass along your kind words.
Roger, I think she's amazing.
I'm sorry we're out of time. We could talk to you all day, but we are out of time. Thank you very, very much.
Congratulations on the book and the message. It's great.
Roger McNamee is the founding partner of the venture capital firm Elevation Partners. His book is Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe. Thank you again, Roger. Up next, Keith Lockhart is here to preview the Boston Pops 2019 spring season. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Brady. She's Marge Regan. So what does Star Wars, Bernadette Peters, and Rick Steves have in common? They're all part of the Boston Pops 2019 star-studded spring season. Here with us in Studio 3 for a preview is Boston Pops conductor Keith Lockhart. Keith, nice to see you.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Marjorie. Good to see you guys.
Great to see you too, Keith Lockhart. But, you know, before we talk about the upcoming season, which sounds amazing, I'm going to talk about your visit down to Florida.
Oh, good.
The Pops performed with the kids from Parkland High School. And Parkland High School, and people may remember, is where there was that terrible massacre on Valentine's Day of last
remember.
Year. Yeah,
we
that's right.
Forget
I hope
too
people,
easily
we
these
do
days.
Forget too easily. Where I believe was it 17 students, I believe, were killed. So what did you do with the students?
Well, this all came together really quickly. And that in itself made me a little nervous. Literally 4 or 5 days before we left on this tour, we got a call from a Broadway orchestrator who does a lot of work for the Pops. And he said, you know, I've just orchestrated the song that the kids wrote in response, the two girls wrote and have been performing. They performed it, I believe, at the U.S. Open.
Yeah, I think so.
And he said, I've done an orchestration for another project they were doing. And he said, you know, you're going to be there just a few days away from the year anniversary. And so we said, well, let's put some feelers out. And it turned out they were very enthusiastic about coming and performing with the Pops at the Broward Performing Arts Center in Fort Lauderdale, which is just down the street. And it all came together, and we rehearsed with them down there. We rehearsed the music up here by ourselves, and then brought the rhythm section together and rehearsed with them right before the performance. And I wasn't sure how it was gonna play. You know, you wonder whether are we continuing? Is this just dragging this back out one more time? That sort of thing. The kids were wonderful. I mean, they were just what you'd want them to be. They were sweet. They were responsive. They were intelligent. They were kind of aware of the import of who they'd become because of this. And when I talked about them, basically, I said, you know, we learned a lot more about the survivors than we did about the victims. The victims, you get the obituary, and that's that. But with the survivors, you learn that there's a resilience and, you know, a strength, the ability to speak truth to power, all those things that these kids have really shown. So it was a magic moment, I mean, for us on stage. And it turned out that it had resonance up here. Thanks you guys both for talking about it afterwards, that I didn't really know that it was going to happen.
It was so, we played a little sound from it when your colleagues, Mark Volpe and Anders Nelsons, were here. And I played some of the video on television. And it is... For those who haven't seen it, you can go online and check it out. But here's just a little taste of the song Shine. Again, it's the Boston Pops with these kids from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. By the way, 17, we know, included teachers and coaches and that sort of thing, as well as students at the Broward Center for Performing Arts in Fort Lauderdale. Here's just a taste. And by the way, I read your comments before. I mean, they were so perfect, Keith. The whole thing was just incredibly beautiful. So congratulations to you and the players and the kids. The whole thing was really powerful.
You know who
great.
Else was really impressive? The parents.
Really?
Yeah. There were, they've been shepherding these. I mean, these kids aren't old enough to go out on their own.
They look
some
so
cases.
Young in
yeah,
the they, pictures.
Yeah, believe me, they every year they just look younger. I don't know why that is. The parents were just so obviously proud of their kids. They stood back. They let the kids run the thing, but they were, you know, they've really had to be an incredible support structure. I mean, every parent's, you know, really called upon to do what parents are supposed to do, I suppose.
And were these kids, what were they? Were they from the a cappella group at the school, or were they just part of the choir, or who were they?
I think that the two young women who co-wrote the song are both very active in the like musical theater side of the activities there, and that they got some of their friends together. I don't think they were from one particular group. I think
okay.
It was kind of a pan high school sort of experience.
Okay, so the spring, check it out online. It is incredibly moving and beautiful. It's really great. Spring season starts May 8th. Let's jump ahead. I know you're going to give us the big picture. Let's do small picture. We love Rick Steves, by the way. And Rick Steves, by the way, here's a quiz for you. Rick Steves is on radio and television with us in late 2016.
Yeah.
What was he here to talk about, Keith Lockhart?
Wow. Dude. I have no idea.
Legalization of marijuana. And I have to say, he campaigns
yeah.
around the country on this issue. It's one of his big causes. What is he doing with you guys?
Now I guess smoking a little weed.
He waited till it passed, and now he's showing up.
That's right. It would be fun to pass out edibles to all the players.
Pro-legalization?
He's pro. And by the way, and I'm not just saying this because he's a big celebrity and obviously PBS connected. He was as articulate and powerful and focused an advocate. Whether you're for or against, the people vote in favor. He was brilliant. He was really terrific. And when I said to him, you're going to lose a lot of support and money for this, and he said, them's the breaks. This is something I believe in deeply, and good for him.
Courage
so,
your convictions.
What is he doing with the Boston Pops?
What he's doing is a little more, a little less controversial, I suppose, than that. Of course, we all know him as the big travel guru, and so many people in our crowd. We, I mean, we have a very PBS crowd, you know, in a lot of ways. His word is gospel. So he's going to take us on a travel log, and there's only one thing that can take you on a travel log better than Rick Steves, and maybe that's music. And so basically, he has a show where he takes you to, down the Moldau River to Prague, or, you know, to Budapest and up to Vienna on the Danube or something like that, and accompanied by music that is reflective of the people and the cultures of those places. So it's all great classical music accompanied by a travel log and great pictures from Rich.
You're going to have the big screen up for this?
Yes, of course.
I love when you have the big screen up. It's always very exciting. But it just adds a great dimension that's really, really, really fun.
Well, we have the big screen up a few times. We have the big screen up, of course, for Star Wars.
Yep.
Which we're doing for the first time here at the Pops, the first movie, the what we now call A New Hope, with the entire score played live by the Boston Pops. And it's an amazingly powerful score. I had the opportunity to do it not here first, but I did it in Taiwan with the National Orchestra of Taiwan about a month ago, and got sick as a dog on my last day in Taipei, too. So, but that's another story. It took me about 3 weeks when I got back to get over that. But the movie, the music and the movie and the orchestra were great, though.
We saw the Los Angeles Philharmonic last night played at the Oscars music by John Williams, and they were doing the In Memoriam piece every year when they had the people that, you know, died during the previous year, and they were a great. It was great to see them on the stage there. But I wondered. Usually, the Oscar music isn't very good. The stuff that gets nominated, but last night it wasn't nominated because, of course, it's been around since Queen. But they opened with Queen. You know, We Are the Champions, mm-hmm. and Radio. What is it called? Radio Silence or Radio Gaga,
Radio
whatever
Gaga.
It is.
Yeah. Yes.
And
with the surviving members, for those who didn't see it.
Yeah, with the surviving members. And Adam Lambert. Adam Lambert was playing, was singing Freddie Mercury. But they had a song that we thought was pretty sexy, Jim and I, although our staff was making fun of us, said it wasn't. But the Shallow song from that Bradley Cooper, who's not a singer, sang with Lady Gaga.
Which is the one that won.
Best song. You know, I guess
I was on a plane. So
yeah,
but
generally speaking, there's not a lot of great, well, except with the exception of someone like John Williams stuff, there's not a lot of great music coming out of the Oscars, is there or is there?
Well, I suppose it depends on your definition of great music.
Yeah.
And music that stands by itself as great music may not necessarily be great film music. And vice versa. There are a lot of films that get nominated for best film score that honestly I didn't realize there was any music in them. And because the function of music is to support what the filmmaker is trying to do. There's every now and then there's somebody so extraordinary like John who writes music that not only supports exactly what the film is trying to do and trying to say, but stands on its own as being worthy of listening to without a film attached to it.
Well, I think I heard, and I think you were, it was you guys that did this, maybe I'm mistaken, at Tanglewood where they played the Haunted House song that John Williams had written about this little house up at Tanglewood.
Oh, right. Yes, that was during the Bernstein.
Yes,
the Bernstein tribute.
Yes, and it was just incredible because it was, you had no movie, you had no plot, you had nothing but the music about a haunted house, one of the houses up there at Tanglewood. And it was,
I've stayed in that house. It's definitely haunted.
So. Well, the song scared you. It was a scary, scary song. And you just had a little inkling of what kind of genius he had.
John is the master, and he can turn you and send you anywhere he wants.
Yeah.
Through music.
And he just did this really easily. Let's get back to the season.
By the way, can I just say, I was just looking as you were talking to Keith, there are a ton of songs, actually, that have won that were...
Like what?
Falling Slowly from Once in 2007 was great.
Well, I don't know if you consider that great music. I don't know.
Song from Selma, like 3 or 4 years, what was it called? Glory or whatever the hell it's called. And there's been some fabulous songs.
Okay, Jim.
By the way, what you missed last night, the reason Marjorie brought this up, you may say, why are they asking me about this? Marjorie and I are of the opinion that the duet between Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga was about the sexiest. The last 30, you got to watch it when you go home. The last 30 seconds.
Did you guys watch the show together?
No, we did. But we came in this morning. We compared notes.
We both agreed. I was playing the song on my telephone as I came in.
In any case, so what else is this spring other than Rick Steves?
Well, we open with Bernadette Peters, which is kind of a gold standard way to open. But we're also bringing Jane Lynch in toward the end of the season.
Yes.
I think a lot of her fans probably don't realize that she is first and foremost a great Broadway performer.
Well, here's one
singer
who didn't know she was a singer. I know her from Glee and other great stuff.
So funny and so good on stage. And she's never been with us before. And we're really excited about that. But I think the real coup is Rhiannon Giddens.
She the July 4th
that's
woman?
That's the July 4th woman. Yeah.
With the
we like to refer to her as the July 4th woman.
Oh, my God. She is. Tell us about her if people hadn't heard her.
Well, she is an American musician, multi-instrumentalist, singer, dancer. She's a recipient not only of Grammys, but of the MacArthur Genius Grant, which is not normally given to performers because she's much more than a performer. She really is a... kind of an explorer of the roots of American music, certainly including the African-American roots of music, but not limited to that. I mean, also very well-versed in Celtic influences and that sort of thing. But on top of that, she's just the most amazingly compelling performer. When she was with us on July 4th, the phone lines just lit up about her performance, and we said, well, we have to get her back. So we're having her back pretty much for a whole week for four performances, two that will feature her in the limelight and two others that we're asking her to curate along with me. In other
words,
well, it means to help program the show, the entire show, to not have it just be her coming out and singing her songs, but to have her enlist a couple of performers whom she thinks are really worth hearing. And for her to serve as kind of the intermediary. You know, Ben Folds has been doing something very similar down at the National Symphony. He's there for all these concerts through the series. He performs on all of them, but a lot of times he just cedes the limelight to somebody. He says, hey, you should really hear this person, or they do a duet together. So we're really excited. We've never done something quite like this before.
Should I be embarrassed I never heard of her until the July 4th thing? I mean,
no, I barely heard of her. I mean, I was vaguely familiar with the Carolina Chocolate Drops, which was a group that she fronted, and kind of knew her through that, but I didn't know she'd won a MacArthur Grant, for that matter, until I read the bio stuff to come on your show.
Well, we were just watching her again this morning the show, and it's really, really something. But of course, you know who else is really something, and I saw him the last time he was here was Leslie Odom.
Leslie Odom Jr.
Oh,
is back.
God.
Do you have a thing with him or something? I mean,
I have a thing. He's got to fulfill his promise because he was supposed to be here last year.
Right.
He got cast in a movie, and that happens. We don't feel bad about that. They have out clauses on these things because there are some things you just got to take, you know. But he promised to be back, and so we're holding him to that, and we just hope he doesn't get cast in a big movie again.
Yeah, and he was in Hamilton, as people may know, and he sang a little bit from that when he was there, right?
Well, you know, the thing is, as it turned out, we had Renee Elise Goldsberry and Philippa Sue, both from two of the original Schuyler sisters from Hamilton instead. And Leslie is great, but nobody missed Leslie. They were fantastic.
Oh, God. The Schuyler Sisters song is one of my favorites from Hamilton. It's a great song. I love that.
And the other thing we're doing, and this will appeal to all of us who are somewhere north of 50, we're doing a 50th. We don't normally do these kind of retrospectives, but 50 years ago this year, particularly this summer, is such a watershed year in American history and in musical culture that we thought we had to say something about it. The two things we're focusing on, and this is all the way through the season as well as on a couple of special concerts that feature Arlo Guthrie, Woodstock being one of them, and of course Arlo was there and is still here and is still performing. He's performed with us several times over the years. We have him back, hopefully recreating his set list from Woodstock.
Okay, stop right there. I do very few impressions. I'm going to do an impression and see either.
Is this
either
Mr. View, Ed?
No, it's not Mr. Ed. I did Mr. Ed a couple of weeks ago.
Okay.
I'm doing a different impression. No,
that's actually
fine.
Very good.
Who did I do that for? Jay Farrow said it was pretty good.
Yeah.
He was mocking
you
me.
Do it again,
no, here's another one. You ready for this?
Yeah.
I'm a farmer. Okay, go ahead. Anybody know who that is? Thank you, John Parker. It's Max Yasger, who owned
the
farm in Woodstock.
Very good.
On which I'm a farmer.
Were you there, Jim?
In all seriousness, do you know the story?
No.
This is one of the worst stories ever. I'm a young busboy at Grossinger's in the Catskills.
Okay, so you were
which
close
was
by.
A huge distance. It's like a, at least 2 miles
yeah, I grew
from
up
Woodstock.
Those places were that only... the Concord Hotel. Yeah,
exactly,
all those places,
right down the road.
2 miles.
It was 2 miles. It's humiliating.
Oh.
Every single busboy and waiter on the first night was. I mean, when I say everybody calls in sick.
Except you.
I don't call it sick. You know why? It's raining. It's going to be muddy. There are no seats. So I would say ultimately maybe 98% of the dining room staff went to Woodstock, and there were about four of us
that
who did not.
That is sad.
That is really
sad
and pathetic. So no, I didn't. But I saw the movie, and I love the movie. So
the...
So what are you doing?
So Woodstock happened, and we're paying tribute to that. It's a huge year in popular music as well. The Beatles broke up, gave their last public performance, released Abbey Road, recorded Long and Winding Road at the same time. Also, Tommy was released,
oh,
the first big
gosh,
rock concept
right.
album.
That was in 69?
And we landed on the moon.
Oh, my God.
Both in the summer of 69, let
okay,
alone
the screen
all the,
gonna be up for that one
I
too.
Mean, all the other, yes,
good,
we commissioned a piece by an American composer named James Beckel called "From the Earth to the Moon and Beyond," which is images
crazy.
of both the space program and the moon. Words of the U.S. presidents associated with it, from Kennedy through Reagan, and the words of the astronauts themselves. It's really cool. So that's part of, and plus we'll be doing David Bowie's space. Oddity attached
oh,
to it. And so, you know, there's enough. But in 60, you know, Nixon became president. So, you know, a huge, whatever side you're on, a huge, you know, watershed.
Wait,
sort
who's
of
on
moment.
His side?
You're right. Actually, kind of like, well, I don't
not
know.
That many
apparently, there
people.
Are some people who will support just about anybody.
Oh, that's
so,
excuse me. Thank you.
I wasn't specific.
Of course not.
Chappaquiddick, the Helter Skelter murders, oh, the Stonewall riots, all it's amazing all that was contained in that year. I mean, of the great and the aspirational and the really terrible.
So let me just say, I don't want to embarrass you, but if you would like me to come and do my Max Yasger imitation as part of the program,
I think maybe maybe the way to intro Arlo.
By the way, I saw him at Farm Aid a couple of years ago. He is still spectacular and creates a feel with you beyond the fact that he's great in his songs.
It's
everybody
the
sings along with
it's the storytelling
great.
That's great.
He's just terrific.
Well, the only question is, do you listen to Arlo Guthrie and his Thanksgiving song before you watch the Best in Show on Thanksgiving Day or after the parade? I mean, when do you fit it in? You have to fit it in, or it's not Thanksgiving, right? I mean,
so,
it's the best.
Can we end where we started? This congratulations on this shine. It really was is as moving as anything I've seen on a stage. It was really beautiful.
Thanks. I was proud of us. I was really proud of the kids.
Good to see you.
Good to see you
Keith
too.
Lockhart.
Don't be a stranger.
Good to see you too. Oh no, I'm gonna book my tickets for some of these things. I'll be there, Keith Lockhart. Keith Lockhart is the Boston Pops conductor. Opening night for the Pops 2019 spring season is May 8th with Bernadette Peters. To learn more about programming, tickets, and showtimes, go to bostonpops.org. Thank you so much for coming in, Keith Lockhart.
Welcome.
Up next, the Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price are here for this week's All Revved Up. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio. He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is 89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1, Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan here with us in Studio 3 to take on the moral dilemmas of the day. Our Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price, they join us every Monday for All Revved Up. Irene is a syndicated religion columnist, the Boston voice for Detour's African American Heritage Trail, and a visiting researcher in the Religion and Conflict Transformation Program at BU School of Theology. Emmett's professor and founding executive director of the Institute for the Study of Black Christian Experience at Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary. Reverend Monroe, Reverend Price, great to see you both.
Thanks
Glad
for having us back.
Glad to be here. Did you watch
watch the Oscars?
We did watch the Oscars. Yeah. We're going to talk about them in just a second because you guys were predicting something, and we're going to talk about your prediction. Anyway, Anne Barrett Doyle is a good friend of ours. She runs something called bishopaccountability.org, a great site of all the misdeeds and horrible crimes committed by priests and bishops all around the world. She's basically given up after going to Rome this week and saying that the church isn't going to do anything and that civil secular authorities are going to have to wrestle this disaster to its knees.
Right. Yeah, I think she has the right to say whatever she wants to. She has been such a vanguard trailblazer in this. And unfortunately, I mean, you know, what the Pope said over the weekend at this big conclave of all the uppity ups was like a rap song. You know, I'm going to do this. I will do this. I'm best at this, and you'll never forget me doing this. I mean, it was just horrible. I mean, you know, I still hold to four things, right? I think the Pope should advocate for the removal of statute of limitations across the world. I think that and I saw the signs of individuals who had signs up to say, yield to secular law. I think we need to yield to secular law now. I think we need to bring the justice system in again across the world. I think the third thing is they need to reveal all the names of people who are suspected, who have, you know, infractions or whatever, and then the Pope must leave.
You know, so it gets back to my premise that I feel like at this point that they cannot police themselves, which makes them makes the church at this point irredeemable. At this point, I think that what also needs to happen here, I'm beyond rage when I heard that they had destroyed, if not redacted, records of people who had come in large complaints here. But there are a couple of things. That zero tolerance, since they can't, you know, install it across the board. I agree with Emmett that we need outside, you know, backup. But I think, again, that it will get rid of the no-stitch policy. It will allow for transparency. It really has to change the curriculum because at this point the curriculum is problematic and they really do need to get rid of celibacy. They really do, because the psychosexual development of these seminarians, and unfortunately who become priests and some become bishop, is really underdeveloped.
Yeah, although, you know, there's been a lot of writing too that you don't want to confuse crime with lust, you know.
What do you mean by that?
Well, because these are not people that are having sex with people because they want to have normal sex. They're people that are preying on little children, which is different. I mean, I don't think that the average person who, for whatever reason, was unable to have a sexual relationship decides they're going to go after 8-year-olds. I mean, to me, there's a gulf between that.
What I'm saying is that you need to get rid of celibacy, and I think
to get women in the church.
But if you're going to get women in the church, I'm sure you don't want them to be celibate either. I think that's a part of it. I think you need a much more embodied, I think when you have a much more embodied theology, then you can have people come out of the closet about sexuality being human.
Who wrote the piece about women priests this week in the New York
Times? Alice McDermott.
It was
great.
A great piece. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
One of the things that one of our listeners last we tweeted at both Irene and I, to her point that the church is irredeemable, that the church is the people. And so the people are redeemable. You're talking about the leadership. You're talking about the upper crust. You're talking about the 1%, as it were. You're talking about the Vatican that has, you know, this you know, bad track, whatever. But the people in the pews, the laity all across the world, they are redeemable.
Yeah,
they should have a sense of divine hope that they can look church will be redeemed.
Right, but the institution isn't. And the reason why I say that I think it needs an embodied theology. If you have an embodied theology, you're dealing with the day-to-day stuff that comes up in the world.
Yeah, which would make the difference. You had women in seminaries, teaching seminaries, women priests. I think that.
But
that
you still
is the
don't want
thing.
To promote. You still don't want to promote a theology of celibacy. You could have women in the church, and you will still have the same problem. You will just reinscribe that same problem if you don't allow people to get married. If you don't have that, I mean, what is gained? What is gained by
millions of people aren't married or aren't having sex? I mean.
Yeah, but they
that's
should have
the problem
that,
with that
but
argument.
They should have
they're
the
not
option,
going after
but
8-year-olds.
It shouldn't be a right. But I agree with that. But the point about it is, it shouldn't be a kind of sort of church edict that you cannot have if you desire to have sexual intercourse, that you can't do it. You cannot have. You cannot be a priest.
Can I have one thing here in terms of the infrastructure of the church, as opposed to, as Emmett says, the people in the pews? You can't say after these 4 days anymore, I don't think, that one has faith that the Vatican can
right.
heal itself.
That's right.
I mean,
yeah,
they
that's
had
right.
an opportunity.
That's right.
All these bishops,
that's
survivors
right.
from all over the world.
That's right.
And they
but we knew
blew
that
it.
Going in, though, didn't we? Because we knew that. What are you? What are we doing? You're using this. You're asking the same people who have perpetuated the
that's
issue
true.
To police themselves. That's the problem there.
But one last thing that it's important to say, because I am a Catholic. I've been a Catholic all my life. Is that many people, including myself, lost faith in the hierarchy of the Catholic Church before I ever knew that there was
right.
pedophilia going
that's
on.
Right.
Because they were on the wrong side on women, they were the wrong side on gay rights, they were the wrong side on birth control, they were the wrong side on divorce and remarried people.
And
so,
celibacy.
So millions of Catholics have ignored what the Church has said since I was, you know, 5 years old, listening to my mother and her friends joke about, you just go to the right priest and nobody's going to worry about birth control. I mean, so the Catholic Church has been way behind and corrupt.
But the institution is problematic.
But the institution has been corrupt for 2,000 years. And this is kind of the dilemma that Catholics have to face. This is nothing new. We've had popes with like 5 and 6 and 7 children out of wedlock, not to mention the attacks
but
on
I
the
think,
Muslims
but see,
and everything
I think
else,
that if
Crusades.
You're saying to me that Catholics have always known this, at some point it makes everybody complicit in maintaining this dysfunctional body here. I don't think there's anything radical to say we need a U-Haul. We need to get rid of these folks that have
then
been perpetuating.
You show me the perfect church.
No, there isn't. But the point
exactly.
I have to tell you. But can I tell you something, though?
So where are you going to go? We're going to go with the Methodists. And
no.
Mess
but let me say this, though.
Yeah.
So you got, like, we have a problem here in the what is it called? Southern Baptist Church.
Right.
A lot of those men have gone to jail. I just think that by being in the closet about it, by having a no-snitch law, by redacting, if not destroying, the records of people who have come forth, you will never get to changing the culture. The culture maintains itself if we say, I know this, we become complicit and do nothing to change it.
Right. But one last thing about this, too. The reason more Catholic priests haven't gone to jail is because nobody believed these kids for decades. And so the same criminal justice system that used to let people who got convicted of rape out in 6 months was not taking women seriously, was not taking children seriously. So it's a bigger picture. I mean, and than just this mess.
You know who stole the moment? That Nigerian nun who spoke truth.
Who lectured
her. Oh,
that's
yeah,
right.
She was great.
Who spoke truth to power.
She was great. And the nuns, I would argue, I wouldn't call them complicit in anything.
No, they're not. They're victims because we're now.
But they do great work. They're out there.
It's not
with
either
the poor
or.
People, and they're not screaming about birth control. You know what I mean? So what I'm going to say, and then I'll shut up, is that the people in the pews that are good Catholics have ignored the church for hundreds and
well,
hundreds of years.
Well, don't you think that? No, I'm not disputing that. So I agree with that. And I agree with Emmett on this, too. It's not the people. It's the church. Don't you think, as a parishioner, you deserve a better church?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And I think the Southern Baptists probably figure they deserve a better church, and the Methodists are fighting about gay rights probably think they deserve a better church. And every religion, there's no perfect religion, is
okay,
my point.
I think this is a grievous one at the moment. Okay, but this is
but,
what I think, though.
What?
I think the turning moment is that, thank God for the Me Too movement, because it is a tidal wave of people who will say, I will not be quiet on this, whether it is the academy, the church, or the music industry.
Speaking
this is the great moment here.
Speaking of the music industry, can we say on young kids for a minute? There seems to have been a consensus for a long time, long before this documentary was made about R. Kelly, that this guy was a bad actor, and finally the documentary has led to some indictments last week. I don't want to talk about him. I want to talk about Michael Jackson, because I think Renee Graham wrote a fabulous piece.
Oh, yeah.
We all know that on March 3rd, Renee Graham, obviously in the Boston Globe, on March 3rd and March 4th, this HBO documentary called Leaving Neverland is going to air, which is a 4-hour documentary. It has a couple of men who say that as kids they were first befriended and sexually abused by Jackson, and the headline of her piece, which she didn't write but summarizes what she's addressing, R. Kelly is canceled. Is it time to cancel Michael Jackson? You know what I loved about this piece? Because I feel almost the same way. I have consciously
and I'm not proud of this, because I have so much love for his work and his music, have contorted myself into a pretzel to figure out how well he was acquitted at the trial. So maybe he, I mean, everybody knew what Leaving Neverland's going to tell us. So should Michael Jackson be, quote, canceled as well, Emmett?
Well, I think people need to decide what their values are, what their morals are, and what they are going to stand for or stand against. And I, in that sense, I have canceled Michael Jackson, as hard as it is for me to say that. I have, you know, growing up on him, the Jackson 5, and, you know, his body of work. And yes, you know, I have been complicit, and so I apologize to the atmosphere for that, because we have known. And we didn't listen, and we did ignore what was uncomfortable, and we made decisions based on our own palates and our own proclivities and
That's
our own stuff.
That's right.
And so I do apologize to the atmosphere for doing that, because we need to stand
we
up.
We knew that. And absolutely. And we hide under this sort of guise and mask of, well, you know, he just loves children. We all accept that he was immature. He wasn't really. He was a male and a child.
Was arrested development in a lot of ways.
The Peter Pan syndrome. Yeah. We all knew this. Again, a moment like Me Too then opens up Pandora's box and make us face what those kids have been screaming and the people who ran the grounds. Now, the thing is this. His parents, the family saying this is a public lynching. Of course, Michael Jackson is not here to defend himself. And I think that if he were here, he would get lawyered up. And I think, again, he would win. But the truth be told, this boy has been a pedophile from the moment, and it was long before that there was this HBO special or whatever special they had, where he says, of course, an act of love is welcoming these young kids in my bed.
But the thing, and I agree with you, most of what you said, the thing is, it's not about Michael Jackson. It's not about R. Kelly. The hand of the law and the hand of legacy and the hand of the chroniclers and the historians will take care of that. It's about us. It's about what have we let slide and what have we ignored and whose voices have we ignored. It's about us.
And so and it's about also not evolving. Because one of the things we have evolved about, we understand sexual abuse in a way that we don't today. For example, I mean, we will look at Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky's episode quite differently in light of how Me Too explains the various gradations of how sexual molestation takes place.
That's why he wasn't invited to campaign with, I don't believe, even one Democrat in the midterm elections, which is a totally different animal than in prior.
Well, you guys both said that.
Let me just say this here. So now what we do here, because we are becoming a woke society around sexual abuse and racism and a whole lot of other stuff. We're making this distinction between their body of work and the person. Someone said to me, well, nobody will be left. What do we do here?
That may be true.
I mean, because look, Wagner was anti-Semitic. Do we throw him out? I mean, we now know about R. Kelly.
I can throw him out. I think his music is horrible.
Okay. Okay. All right. But
we're not talking about Billy Jean.
Okay. Really.
Okay.
You
know, I think every wedding you've gone to for the last 20 years,
but
the music
comes on,
you're
hopping up. Roman Polanski. Let's look at Woody Allen. I mean, Bill Cosby. I mean, we can just now go. Who is left? Some says that the kind of redacting that we're doing in this incident, as well as with, you know, removing certain statues like we want to do in Faneuil Hall, nobody will be left. It's erasing history as opposed to let the work stand for itself and tell the truth behind the body of work.
Speaking of history, Marjorie is contending that you, what did you say, what happened if Green Book won Best Picture?
I thought you guys both predicted
that's
it would
right.
be terrible if Green Book
that's
won.
That's right, absolutely.
If somebody said spoon-feeding racism to white people.
That's what I did. I said
absolutely. Did you see when they won the last, when Julia Roberts gave the award, did you see all those white men up there? I was fascinated by
point.
That.
That's a great point.
I was
point.
Absolutely fascinated
by
that.
Was there anybody besides Ali associated with that
he
movie?
Was there.
And that was it.
No. There was three. Octavia Spencer was there,
Spencer.
And there's another black man.
She's done this twice now.
Yes,
the help. A twofer. And, you know.
So are you saying that there's something good about distorting this narrative about Don Shirley, who the only person that gave any homage to Don Shirley? Okay. And that it's that if so falls into the trope of the white savior here. You're telling me that there's something good about whitewashing the civil rights history because white people feel comfortable. It makes them feel comfortable to look at racism.
Yeah,
is this what you're telling me?
I think
that's
what
the
academy decided. Oh. But I thought the best line.
So that's what you're telling me.
No, okay,
Ease up, Irene.
I thought
it's Monday.
The best thing about this whole thing, Spike Lee's there last night. One of the contenders, Black Klansman. And a lot of people were saying, you know, this is like Driving Miss Daisy the second
time around.
That's
right. It's a white version of it.
And Spike Lee's line, I love this. He said, every time somebody's driving somebody, I'm losing, which I thought was great because
Driving Miss Daisy came out the
same year as
Do the Right Thing.
Do the Right Thing.
Yeah, but I also the director is known for exposing his genital. That came out.
Fairly.
Yeah, yeah. That,
oh,
you
my
know,
God,
including
that.
That's right. Including to Cameron Diaz. That's
by the way,
right.
He never mentioned Shirley in either of his accessories.
That's right. That's right.
And Vito Morgan.
That's right. The writer of it, which is, I can't pronounce his name here. What is it? Vigo, what is his name?
Vito Morgenstern,
right?
Or something?
That's the son of the actual guy in the movie, right?
His anti-Semitic statement where he says that Muslims in New Jersey were cheering when the towers went down and that he agreed. He agreed with Donald Trump. So my point is that the Academy, as much as that we're trying to say that the Academy is so white, it is still so white. Because it appropriates, if not destroy, black narratives and award white people for bastardizing them.
Well, but wait, there are a couple of categories, sort of behind-the-scenes categories that I don't understand enough, where African-Americans won for the first time in the history of Oscars. So while Green Book may have been not the best choice.
Yeah, I mean, Ruth Carter, our homegirl from Springfield, Massachusetts, she got costume
She did
design.
A shout-out to her mother, right? She
Hannah,
lives in Massachusetts.
Right, for Black Panther. Hannah, is it Beechler?
I don't know how to say
okay,
that.
Okay, for production design. I also think that, and I have to tell you, you may not have watched the Grammys, but you missed a fashion moment because we always talk about what the women are wearing.
The Oscars.
I mean, the Oscars. But Billy Porter, who came out with the tuxedo dress.
Yeah.
The tuxedo gown was stunning. Was stunning. And I love what he said. He said, I felt beautiful and unapologetically masculine.
By the way, he did look great. He really looked fabulous.
That's right.
Yeah. I don't think I could pull it off, but he did look.
You know, Regina King brought her mom and gave kudos to her mom. She won for Best Supporting.
That made me cry, by the way.
But let me tell you this that bothered me.
Beale Street actress?
Yeah.
I love that.
Rich Crazy Asians, I was really surprised they got slighted. I was surprised that A Star Is Born. Come on.
I like the sappy song from A Star Is Born.
It was very well done.
Didn't you think?
Goodness.
I thought it was pretty sexy.
Oh,
my
goodness.
Okay.
It was wonderful.
We're vindicated now. It's not just you and me, Jim. The oldsters here, they think it was sexy,
it was,
too.
Yeah.
I thought it was
Lady
wonderful.
Lady Gaga and Bradley Cooper are not oldsters, Marjorie.
No,
you
not.
May be and I may be, but they're not.
No, they're not.
In any case, great to see you,
I liked that movie, even though it was flawed.
Flawed? Not
they're
as much
flawed.
Talk about flawed. Green Book is what is flawed.
Oh, we heard that. I think we knew that. That's fine.
Okay.
But it gets an award for being flawed.
Yeah.
I think the Diocese of Boston is on the phone. They want to give you an award.
They should. You know why? They should, because I started out as a Catholic.
There you go.
And left the Catholic Church.
But the nuns brought you up, Irene.
Look what they did for you. And they thought when I became a Protestant that I had lost my religion.
Nice to see you, too. See you next week.
Irene Monroe and Emmett Price join us every week. Irene is a syndicated religion columnist, the Boston's voice for Detour's African-American Heritage Trail, a visiting researcher in religion and conflict transformation program at BU's School of Theology. Emmett Price is a professor and founding executive director of the Institute for the Study of the Black Christian Experience at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary. Irene and Emmett, thank you very much. Coming up, we're going to talk some more about the Oscars and a bunch of other great TV news with Bob Thompson. He's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And long before last night's broadcast, the Oscars, as you know, was fraught with controversy, from introducing a most unpopular film category, most popular film, to tapping Kevin Hart as the host, to going hostless, and then announcing it would streamline the broadcast by handing out awards during the commercial breaks. After all, isn't an ad for Verizon more important than who wins for best cinematography? Despite its many stumbles down the red carpet, did it regain its stride as a watchable TV awards ceremony show? Joining us for his take on this and other TV news is Bob Thompson. Bob's a founding professor and, pardon me, a professor and founding director of the Bleier Center for TV and Popular Culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse. Hello there, Bob.
Hello, you guys.
Hello, Bob Thompson. So give us the over-under. What did you think, overall think of the Oscars? And we'll get into the details.
Okay, well, first of all, at some point you're going to ask me what my worst was, yeah. And I always reserve my worst on this Monday after the Oscars for the Oscars. So, but in the end, it wasn't that bad.
I agree.
I hate to use this word again, but it was a perfectly competent broadcast. By the way, I had predicted last year that it would go 3 hours and 24 minutes. If you went to the end of the last credits, it was 3 hours, 22 and a half. So
very
I was within
good.
90 seconds.
So I have I thought Marjorie and I both, I thought it was brilliant since there was no host. How are they going to open it? As everybody knows who watched, they open it with the surviving members of Queen and Adam Lambert singing Freddie Mercury. And then there's this thing where I have to say I love all three of these women anyway, but Tina Fey, Amy Poehler, Maya Rudolph come out, and here they joke about hosting the Oscars. Here they are.
Good evening, and welcome to the 1,000,000th Academy Awards. We are not your hosts, but we're going to stand here a little too long so that the people who get USA Today tomorrow will think that we hosted.
I thought that combo, them and the
They're
band,
funny.
Was a great
yeah.
opening to the show, Bob.
It was, and they went ahead and made fun of all kinds of things that the Oscars have gotten in trouble for, the popular film category and all of this other kind of stuff. So those two, when you ever need, they're like those fixers in a gangster movie. When you need something fixed, you bring those three in, and they fixed it. Now, all this nice things we're saying now, I would not say that there were any real memorable moments that we'll be putting in the montage in the History of Oscars documentary. Matter of fact, I'm not sure there's any moments that we'll be still remembering on Thursday about this broadcast. But it got done, almost on time. And interestingly enough, the overnight ratings, which aren't too reliable, those will change. But its ratings are up from last year. Now, that's not saying much because last year was the lowest ratings ever for the Oscars, but they're up anywhere from 4 to 14%, depending on which numbers you look at.
You know, I think Marjorie and I think I speak for Marjorie to say we differ with you on one thing in terms of memorable moments. We both came in, we didn't text each other last night, we both came in this morning saying that we thought the last 30 seconds of Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga doing Shallow was about as sexy as it gets on live television. What do you think?
Well, and the fact that it was live television, I'm glad you made that distinction, because that kind of thing happens all the time in movies and extreme close-ups and all that kind of thing. But you don't generally see that kind of erotic voltage on an Oscar broadcast by any stretch. It's not easy to cover that stuff live. So I'll give you that. And there was the speech from the person who won Best Short Documentary was pretty interesting. But apparently the big thing happened was Spike Lee turning his back on the Green Book. But I don't think that broadcast, I don't think we saw that. I went back and looked again, and I couldn't see it.
There are reports, for those who didn't read about what Bob is speaking about, that he got out of his seat when Green Book got the award. Obviously, his film was The Black Klansman was nominated as well, and started to walk up the aisle. The contention is he wanted to leave the theater. He ended up not leaving the theater, but it created a little minor to-do there. So apparently
he did win his first Oscar, yeah, though, for adapted screenplay, and that was a pretty big deal because he's been doing some pretty important films for a long time. I still am amazed this was his first Oscar.
And remember in the picture, he gets up on the stage, and he's kind of a diminutive guy. He jumps into the arms of Samuel Jackson, who catches him in his arms like a kid. It was a great picture.
So there's no worse.
We're going to see as Shaft again come June.
That's right. There's no worst, apparently. But I assume you have a best this week, Bob Thompson?
A documentary now. Started its 52nd season, as Helen Mirren tells us in the beginning. It's actually its third, but they pretend that it's its 52nd. And this consistently, for one thing, I'm amazed that this show still goes on, because it is parodies of documentaries that an awful lot of people haven't seen, from Nanook of the North.
That was my favorite.
Documentaries.
I love that one.
That was my favorite, too. Thin Blue Line, Great Gardens, I guess a lot saw that. But they opened this time with a two-parter based on a recent Netflix documentary, Wild Wild Country, that played back in just about a year ago, and that has already been parodied by Saturday Night Live. So it obviously had moved into the cultural, penetrated the cultural territory. And Owen Wilson, Michael Keaton, Connie Chung. And with all these documentary nows, I always recommend you watch the documentary that it's parodying first, and then you watch the documentary now parody. But that's not necessary. You can actually enjoy these, I think, without knowing what they're referring to.
Well, we've got a clip from this spoof. This is of the Netflix documentary series that you just mentioned, Bob, Wild Wild Country, from the first episode of the third season documentary now.
Ra Shabart was my father. I had a biological father, but he wanted me to have a job and take on responsibilities. He never understood me. But Father Ra Shabart did. He just wanted me to be free and happy. And isn't that what a father is supposed to want for his children? That's why it was an honor to give him the money my real father gave me when he died.
By the way, I can't even believe they do these. When I saw the – was Nanook of the North the first – it was the first one. Wasn't it the first one?
I think it might have been the second, but I think it was the first one that was produced. But, of course, Nanook of the North is the first documentary you always see in a Film 101 class. So,
but is that – are you not amazed – I mean, you're the expert in this area, and this is where you spent – that this has lasted for three – these knockoffs, these spoofs of famous – I mean, it's unbelievable, actually.
Well, they're really subtle. I mean, yes, I am amazed. This is a third season. And this one I can understand, because actually Wild Wild Country is a new documentary. It got a lot of attention. There are plenty of people out there who understand what it's referring to. But a lot of these documentaries that they have made fun of are things you see, as I said, in film classes, not things that most people have seen. But they're short. They're a half hour long. They manage to stand up on their own as funny. I think they're really brilliantly done. And anybody who teaches a history of documentary film, these are going to be wonderful things to dip into for a little comic relief. And by the way, this is now such a rich time for documentaries. There's so many wonderful documentaries being every week. There's new ones, but it's also a rich time for parodies. This show from IFC, Documentary Now. And, of course, American Vandal, which has done two seasons as well, which takes that idea of true crime and completely turns it on its head.
We're talking to Bob Thompson, our TV guy.
Okay, Bob Thompson, tell us a little bit about John Oliver's return.
Oh, yes, after 3 months. And, by the way, if you were gone for the last 3 months and you're a news satirist, you missed some kind of important stories. So he comes back a week ago Sunday. He did Brexit and a thing on New Zealand, where he points out how New Zealand is left out of all these maps. And sure enough, it is. And he came up with all this, including an IKEA map of the world. And IKEA, of course, has just opened its first store in New Zealand.
That's
and it doesn't even include it on its world map. But the best part is he then, on the Twitter account of John Oliver, you can print out a map of New Zealand, and it's got a little dotted line to cut around, and then you can go and affix it to all the maps that have left New Zealand out.
It's a riot. Great. I happen to see he's just a riot. I wish he were on more often than once a week. Okay, let's talk about can we do our new feature now?
We can.
Okay, we have a new feature, in case you missed it, as in ICYMI. What should we have seen that we missed?
Wait, what do those letters stand for? In case you missed it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
I guess you didn't know that. That's our
name.
Well,
it's a new feature. It takes me a while. I don't adapt well to change.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Well, Jim mentioned this last week as something that he thought we should have done a What You Should Watch, and I had almost done it of What You Should Be Watching, and it debuted back on January 28th, so it's about a month old. But this is the HBO documentary Breslin and Hamill, Deadline Artists. And I think, again, another really fine documentary that talks about an era of journalism that, alas, has passed.
Yeah, it was great. I watched it
over
the weekend.
Oh, you did? Oh, I didn't know you
watched
it.
I watched it over the weekend. I absolutely loved it. Yeah, when they have all the people. One of the great scenes is they show the modern-day subway, and everybody in the subway got their face in their phone, and then they show the subway back 25 years ago, and everybody in the subway had their face in either the New York Daily News or the New York Post.
That's how it opens, right.
Yeah, with the great post headlines.
Of many, many parts, and there were lots of things I loved about this, including the really depressing end. It starts with, as you point out, the phones versus the papers. It ends with the statistic. In 1988, the New York Daily News, for whom both Breslin and Hamill had worked, had 400 reporters and editors. In 2018, it had 45. That is like 10% of what they had before. But my favorite part was they're talking about covering a 1951 baseball game. This is 1951, mid-20th century, and how all the reporters are putting the film that they take from the baseball game into tubes for pigeons, carrier pigeons.
That's right.
One to go to the Daily News, one to go to the Post, one to go to the Herald, whatever. That to me is so charming that within the lifetime of many people walking around today, journalists were still using carrier pigeons as a delivery technology.
You know, for those who are of a certain generation where you don't know of Jimmy Breslin and Pete Hamill, who sort of dominated the media for a couple of decades in New York City, if you whether you're a journalist, a would-be journalist, or just care about the quality of journalism, these guys were at the center of virtually every major story in New York, and many of them became national. They drove the news on a ton of these stories. It is an extraordinary couple of hours, so I'm glad you brought it back up, Bob.
The important thing, too, is they were local guys.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's disappearing as news moves into an internet phenomenon. Yeah. Papers are closing all over the country. And they talked about Breslin, of course, was most famous for getting the story of the guy who dug JFK's grave.
Yeah.
He did a big story on JFK's ER doctor. When everybody else is covering the assassination, he managed to slip into these territories. And there are very, very few people doing that anymore.
By the way, when you were sent, Marjorie, when you covered the OJ trial and you were sent to when you said the hundreds and hundreds of reporters were at the courthouse, didn't your editor, in the spirit of that,
my boss,
that piece,
to copy Jimmy Breslin? Jimmy Breslin went to the grave of JFK, interviewed the grave digger, as you just said, and he sent me to the cemetery where Nicole Brown Simpson was buried, predicting that that would fill up with women who had also been beaten by boyfriends and husbands. And he was totally right. I mean, in a couple of hours, there might have been. Couple of hundred women that came there because she, of course, had predicted that he would kill her and no one would care. Let's move on to something that really got my blood boiling, though.
Laura Logan
going on a doing an interview, and she
Sean
also,
Hannity, right?
Yeah, I think she was interviewed first by a Navy SEAL and then she went on Sean Hannity. Am I right about that, Bob?
Right. She went on a podcast with Mike Ritland, who, you're right, is a former Navy SEAL, and that was, I think, a week ago Friday, and then she went on Hannity on, I believe it was Wednesday.
Yeah, and talked about how they not only have the standards in journalism slip, but the media is mostly liberal. 85% of the journalists are registered Democrats. I don't know where she gets that figure from.
I don't know where she gets that figure either, because I haven't found that. I have seen 7% of journalists are registered Republicans, but I certainly haven't seen this 85% registered as Democrat.
Well, the thing that really drove me crazy is, has she not heard of Sinclair Broadcasting, which is a very conservative pro-Trump station that is taking over local news stations
all around
the country, where people are parroting these documents that they have to read. I hope they've stopped doing that after they were exposed for doing that. Or, of course, she mentions Fox News, like Fox News is not the biggest thing on cable. I mean, it's just not true. what she's saying.
Well, that's the thing. Whenever Fox News continues to play this, you know, David versus Goliath, this underdog, they forget who owns Fox News, who is about as underdog as there is nobody less an underdog, and they forget that it is the number one cable news network in the country and has been for a long time. Now, she does make a point, and this gets us back to the Breslin and Hamill thing. This idea, and I'm not, I don't know where she got this 85% registered Democrat. I think most journalists are actually operating according to professional journalistic standards. But the notion that journalism has, I think, really become, in professional cases, something that is centered on the places that are able to stay in business. And those tend to be located on the two coasts. Somebody in the website The Hill just wrote a very interesting piece about this. And the fact that, you know, journalism used to be necessarily local because you had all these newspapers all across the country. Each one of them had their own Breslin and Hamill, maybe not quite as good of writers. And those have gone away. We don't even have a daily newspaper in Syracuse anymore. And I think there is a sense, therefore, that kind of local viewpoint has changed. She's interpreting that as liberal over conservative. Many people think because she's applying for a job at Fox, which, by the way, in that interview, Hannity said, "I hope my bosses at Fox find a place for you." He came right out and said it. But the point she's making is one that's worth exploring in some more complex ways.
Can I ask one? I didn't see this, which obviously you two did. Is she content? By the way, I'm not. If she's saying that the vast majority of reporters in their personal lives are liberal leaning, I'm not. I don't have the stats. I'm not surprised by that at all. That to me is irrelevant. What's relevant is even if that's true, or if 85% of them were registered Republicans, is it reflected in their reporting? And if it isn't, I mean, everybody has an opinion. So is her contention that that affects the quality of their reporting because of their registration?
Yes.
Is that her point?
I think that is her point. Not only that, but the fact that she is committing, quote unquote, career suicide by even saying this. So she's really positioning herself that, yes, this affects how people report, and it will affect how people treat her.
Job interview. So what are we watching this week, Bob Thompson?
I guess Wednesday, isn't it?
Is
the public?
Yes, it is.
Michael Cohen testimony on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, but Wednesday is the only one we get to see, the House Oversight Committee. That ought to be interesting.
Yeah, and by the way, we are carrying it live on the radio for those not lucky enough to be calling in sick that day to watch it on television at home. So that's our thing of the week, too.
Yeah.
Hey, Bob, it's great to talk to you. Thanks. We really appreciate your time.
It's always fun. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bob Thompson. Bob Thompson joins us every Monday. He's the founding director of the Blyer Center for TV and Popular Culture and a trustee professor of TV and Popular Culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse. Coming up, opening the lines up and asking what you thought about the Oscars and whether you thought the Lady Gaga Bradley Cooper thing was, what did Bob call it?
Erotic voltage.
Was the
erotic
voltage moment of the evening or not? We're opening up the lines and asking you about just not that, but what you thought of the Oscars. Green Book, who won, who lost, Roma. Is it still relevant in 2019, or by making Green Book the best movie, is the Oscar thwarting its effort to be relevant anymore? Listen to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. Marjorie is taking a cold shower. Now, if your office is like ours,
than everyone this morning. We're talking about Donald Trump for one day, talking about the Oscars. Who got snubbed? Who wore what? Why? As the New York Times pointed out, did the stage look like a cross-section of a baked Alaska? And was a night without hosts a night to remember? The New Yorker and The Atlantic called the ceremony irrelevant for awarding films that seemed like relics from the 90s. And a New York Times critic reiterated that writing is a great line. Congratulations to Driving Miss Daisy for being the first movie to win Best Picture twice. Obviously talking about Green Book. At a certain point, do the winners and losers even matter? Do you tune in for the spectacle? Do you tune out because you just don't care? Is it time for us? Well, 877-301-8970. If you've been listening to the show today, Marjorie and I thought the major takeaway is that performance. We didn't get to say this to Bob Thompson. You know what I loved about it? I love that they walked out of the audience. They weren't in. They weren't introduced.
No. Nope.
There was just the people set up the piano and the mic stand for Bradley Cooper. They walk up hand in hand out of the audience and start singing the film, the song that won Best Song of the Year. But I have to say, and we didn't compare notes last night, but Marge and I, our first reflection, both of us, Jason, our coworker, is shaking his head like, how pathetic
he's
are these two?
He's disgusted with us both.
That, I thought it was one of the sexiest, as I said to Bob, one of the sexiest couple of minutes on live TV I've seen in a long time.
It's because they did have, as Bob Thompson said,
erotic voltage.
I mean, they had, for lack of a better word, chemistry. They had unbelievable erotic chemistry. They did in the movie, which wasn't so great, but they did on the stage last night when he threw the microphone back and walked over and pulled up his pants and sat down next to her and Mike nuzzled into her cheek. Mm. It was pretty good. At the end of the song, the way she looked at him was pretty good, too. So it was sexy, I thought. But you know what? I think this is a generational thing. None of my kids watch the Oscars. They have absolutely no interest in watching the Oscars. Maybe they'll look the next day to see who the best picture was. But I think it's something that I've kind of grown up with my whole life. You've got to watch the Oscars. You've got to watch the Oscars. It's very exciting. And so I'm not sure if everybody else is.
Well, can I tell you, I decided to reform a little bit. I decided last night I was only going to watch 2 hours of the red carpet ceremony beforehand. So I tried to limit myself to 877-301. 89. I actually thought it was a pretty entertaining television show.
I
as we talked about, Maya Rudolph and Amy Poehler and Tina Fey, I thought were a riot.
And if you haven't seen Bohemian Rhapsody, which also wasn't a great film, but I really loved it because you sit there basically for an hour and a half listening to Queen music, and you have this guy that won Best Actor, Rami Malek, just absolutely being fantastic as Freddie Mercury. They opened instead of with the lame jokes.
I agree with that.
And they're not always lame jokes. Jimmy Kimmel was pretty good the last couple of years. But
Chris Rock's pretty good. I mean, there's
Chris
some
Rock
who are great.
Chris Rock was great. Race, but that was a while ago. But anyway, it opened up with music, so it was great. You heard the older guys that were still with Queen, who were fantastic. The guy that plays guitar for them is fantastic, and Adam Lambert was singing.
He was pretty good too.
He wasn't Freddie Mercury, but it wasn't bad, and so that was pretty good.
Do you know what we failed to mention before we take calls at 877-301-8970? Did you happen to see the duet between Bradley Cooper and? Oh, I'm sorry we mentioned that. 877-301-8970.
Well, you know, it's one of these tearjerkers of a movie. I mean, it kind of went south quickly.
I don't care about the movie.
What, you don't,
I didn't
care
see,
about
I don't
the
know.
Movie? I think you should watch the movie, Jim, to be fully versed in the Bradley Cooper,
I don't need to be fully
Lady
versed.
Gaga situation.
You know what I've told you through the years? I think that one of the sexiest scenes in a movie ever, I've told you what this one is. I've decided this
the
long.
The rain.
No. Body Heat.
Oh, Body Heat.
When William Hurt is about to break in. Remember that, what's her name again? John will know. Thank you,
Kathleen
John.
Turner.
Kathleen Turner is standing behind a glass door, and you could see, literally see the heat. It's somewhere in the South, Louisiana or something.
Yeah.
And you can, in the cinematography allows you to see the heat as it's so intense, and he ultimately breaks down the door to get through. That's a fairly sexy scene, but this one, I'll tell you. Is this? I thought last night it was great.
I thought the Oscars last night were much better than usual. It was a lot more diversity. They want to know if we know that the guy who plays guitar for Queen has a PhD in astrophysics. I did know that only because I watched the movie Bohemian Rhapsody, from which what?
Who wrote that note to me about the microcosmos? Please, that was Amanda. Okay, so it is true, and then we'll get to the calls. I have said. That the Microcosmos, which is a film that none of you have ever heard of.
This is insects having sex.
It's not just insects. It's dung beetles.
Dung beetles.
Having sex.
Previous to Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga.
I know. Well, they didn't have sex.
It was
sexy.
That was the sexiest moment you ever saw.
Microcosmos, the dung beetles. It's a documentary. I don't think there's any narration at all. It's just watching animals interact, let's put it that way, with each other. These two dung beetles are having sex. I'm telling you, rather than a lot, I'm being ridiculed by all of my coworkers in the control room. go watch it and then call us or email us tomorrow and tell me that is not an incredible. See, they're wrapping their bodies around each other
right,
and
Jim,
just twirling around kind
try
of thing.
Try to control yourself. Robert says the only one memorable moment for me last night was Charlize Theron looked spectacular in her silver blue Dior gown. Let's just say.
Who was that?
Pippa has nothing
who's that?
On her.
Who?
That's from Robert.
No, who was he talking about?
Charlize Theron.
It was
Theron.
Not silver.
The
it was blue.
Mom, well,
I knew she
it was.
Is. She
it
was
like
blue.
A turtleneck.
With an open back.
Yes, with an open back. I mean, you have to watch the red carpet because you've never seen such spectacular-looking people in your entire life. They're all actors and actresses. And
that's a very good point, Marjorie.
Yeah, but also I liked, speaking of somebody who's not in spectacular shape and she doesn't give a damn, is Melissa McCarthy.
Oh, that's,
who came
that was
out,
great.
Who came out with this long train with all these rabbits kind of on the train, and then she kind of did a pantomime along to her award speech. By the way, that movie I've got to see. I haven't seen that one. People say that's a really good one. How Can You Ever Forgive Me? She was nominated for the Oscar for Best Actress. A lot of people thought Glenn Close was going to win the Oscar for Best Actress because she'd been nominated 6 or 7 times.
Like our coworker said that if Microcosmos had been set to the song Shallow, it would have made me melt. Maybe it would. And if it did, that's fine. Everybody has different tastes.
Well, you know, I just also thought the first time I ever saw Bradley Cooper in a movie was years ago when he was in Wedding Crashers and he was the obnoxious boyfriend that was tackling everybody in the football and he was screaming at people and he was, out of control.
He was almost on our show last year for about 30 seconds until they canceled. Yeah.
But he came across like a big movie star last night, too. You know, certain movie stars have
it was,
that.
That's
whole
a great,
thing.
That's exactly yeah. what that was, you know, like a big movie star
very,
moment.
Very, very graceful and very charming when he came around. On the piano, and he kind of tucked his pants up a little bit. And
moved the
down,
mic aside.
Moved the mic and just burrowed right in there.
Well, I don't know if you burrowed. Those would be the dung beetles who burrowed
he
in there.
Burrowed into her neck.
Abby in Marlborough, thanks for your patience. You're first on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about the Oscars after the fact, just for a break from Trump. Hi, Abby.
Hi. I love them. I thought it was great. But I think it's an age thing. I think you guys are right. I'm 48. I'm going to be 49 in March. And I don't think I know anyone younger than me who gives a crap about the Oscars. I love it. I love all of it. I think it's awesome. It is what it is. They're all congratulating each other. And I don't know. It's just fun.
I like it. Now, have you seen Microcosmos, Abby, or have you not?
I have not.
Can you rent it or just go? It's probably on demand. And let me know what you think in the next couple of days. Is that okay? Thank you, Abby.
Yeah, a little homework assignment.
Okay, so Abby self-identified as 48. If we can get somebody under 48 to give us a buzz, 877-301-8970, and tell us if this is not something that the under 48 crowd even gives a whit about.
Jill has chastised me, and she's right. I should have pointed out that the guy playing the guitar was Brian May himself from Queen. I didn't say that.
Oh, yeah. I think they're both surviving members of Queen.
Well,
Freddie
Mercury died of AIDS.
Well, he's not surviving.
But it wasn't that long ago. So these guys are, I don't know, in their 50s or something.
You know what
like
I've
that?
Learned? I know this is not an original thought, but why not say it anyway, Jim? Mm-hmm. Is it is best when you admire someone's work, like these actors and actresses, not to hear them interviewed. What's the name of the guy who played Freddie Mercury again?
Rami Malek.
Yeah, I listened. I was driving back from Montreal around Christmas time, and I listened to a whole hour-long interview that Terry Gross did with him, and it was singularly unimpressive. Not her. She's great. But he was just not much, and it's sort of... It shouldn't ruin because obviously they're playing a part, but it does for me a little bit.
Well, he's also young. He hasn't had time
young
to
has nothing to do with it.
Into a movie star. You know what I mean?
Let's go to Barb in East Falmouth. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Thank you very much for calling. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon.
You too.
I thought the show was really well done without a host. I thought that worked well. We both sat there and watched the whole thing, which we don't normally. We would be pacing and getting up and leaving, and I thought each part was good. But I think that as time goes on, more and more, you have to be an educated viewer of the Oscars because, for example, Marjorie, you mentioned Melissa McCarthy's train. If you didn't see The Favorite, you would not realize that the rabbits are probably one of the most significant
scenes
in the movie.
Yeah.
And it's, in fact, a hard one to watch for animal lovers. But that said, it was pretty funny that she picked up on that. And
Didn't the queen have like 17 rabbits in her bedroom or something?
Yes, but it becomes an issue when the two ladies in waiting are vying for the queen's attention,
yep.
and the rabbit suffers as a sort of torment because of that.
And that's all.
By the way, I didn't see The Favorite, and I had no idea that was about. So you're right. I'm an uninformed viewer. I liked it anyway, but Barb, you were dead on there. Thank you very much for the call. 877-301-8970. So Donald Trump got up this morning and decided he would tweet about Spike Lee rather than Kim Jong-un. And he was upset because Spike Lee, who won his first Academy Award, in a competitive kind of thing. I think he's gotten some honorary thing before, but he's amazing. And here is a little bit of Lee's acceptance speech.
We all connect with our ancestors. We will have love, wisdom, regaining. We will gain our humanity. It will be a powerful moment. The 2020 presidential election is around the corner. Let's all mobilize. Let's all be on the right side of history. Make the moral choice between love versus hate. Let's do the right thing. You know I had to get that in there.
So was that the worst? Was that the worst thing he said about Trump?
Yeah.
Love versus. He didn't even reference him by name,
no,
did he?
No, he didn't.
So just love versus hate.
And Trump said he'd done more for African Americans than any president ever. And he cited the unemployment numbers.
And something else, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay,
877. You know, we didn't get a chance to talk about it earlier in our political section. But
what's up?
Although African Americans have remained stalwart in their opposition to Donald Trump, Hispanic Americans, not so much. And there's growing concern among Democrats. The assumption that Hispanic Americans are going to be with the Democrats because of what the president has said about Mexicans and because of separating children at the borders. But that's not necessarily so.
You know who wrote that piece for Politico?
Yeah,
David Bernstein, our colleague
It was a great piece.
A good piece.
And the explanation was that Hispanic voters are, especially if they've been in America a while, are quite conservative on social issues.
Let's go to Alyssa and Quincy. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Alyssa.
Hi, how are you? I love your show.
Thank you.
And a few minutes, I've been listening all morning, and I was I almost spit my coffee out when Marjorie said that, you know, Bradley Cooper just burrowed right in there. I thought that
literally
was a great line.
Yeah, and she meant it, too. Trust me.
I felt like I should have a shower after
yeah.
I watched that.
Think of the people that you want burrowing into your neck. You know what I'm saying?
No, but wait a second. I think she was about to say that was an incredible couple of moments, wasn't it?
It was fantastic.
Oh,
are you kidding me? It was great. But the reason I'm calling is, and Marjorie will appreciate this, I have a wonderful priest that I admire. And at church a couple of weeks ago, he brought up the movie Green Book. And he suggested that everybody see Green Book because it's never irrelevant to remind us of what people have suffered in the past and how they still suffer. And that, you know, it was a lovely comment that he made. And I thought, you know, with people saying, oh, it's Driving Miss Daisy part two. No, it's another look, another view, and a good reminder of how love can overcome, you know, such terrible, terrible things.
Yeah, but Alyssa, the criticism, and I just saw it over the weekend. I hadn't seen it before, is that it's a sanitized version. And there's truth in that. Don't you think?
Well, that's what I hear. I mean, I'm not a movie critic. I love movies. But I just know I went in and I felt everything that both of them felt.
Okay.
And I thought they learned. And I came out of there feeling, you know, like, oh, that was a great opportunity to, you know, a feel-good movie in terms of how somebody can turn around and see the pain and suffering of somebody else.
Yeah, Alyssa, thank you for the call. And, you know, people may not have known your reference before when the Revs were here about you're saying Octavia Spencer is now struck out twice in a row or whatever
yeah.
you said. It's because at the time when The Help came out, your criticism of The Help was exactly what some are criticizing Green Book for.
Well, it's this idea that the criticism for Green Book is that the Academy Award seems to love movies about white people rescuing black people. And there's a long history of this, you know, whether we go back to, you know, Gone with the the Wind, when everybody, you know, in that film, everybody was lovely to all the slaves. You know, it was you know, there was nothing terrible about slavery. Or Mississippi Burning, you know, the people that became the heroes were Gene Hackman, the white people that swooped down into Mississippi. And in The Help, it was the same thing, where these African-American maids were being treated horribly. And the savior, once again, was this white woman who wrote a book about it. So that's the problem, and that was the problem with Driving Miss Daisy, too, this idea that white people are running around saving black people all the time, which kind of is a distortion of what goes on. And by the way, somebody, and I just had a second to look at it, someone, and I've lost the email now, but thank you for sending it to me, pointed out Seth Meyers has done an entire takeoff on the white savior mode, where he injects himself into every moment.
Of civil rights history you're talking about?
Well, of scenes from movies. Oh, I see. And he injects himself into the movies. So that's the problem with Green Book, is that that, and also the other problem with Green Book is that, according to the family of this pianist,
Don Shirley,
they took really huge liberties, never even spoke to the family.
Well, you know, Peter Farrelly? Mm-hmm. Is he the Farrelly brother who was I said this earlier in the show, but I think he in many ways underlined the criticism of his own film when he never mentioned Dr. Shirley, as he was called. The African-American pianist who's at the center of the story, unlike Mahershala Ali, who paid beautiful tribute to him when he was awarded, you know, best supporting actor. By the way, is he unbelievable? You know, I never heard of this guy until he was in House of Cards. You know, when he's having an affair with the woman who ends up being the chair of the Ways and Means Committee or the Speaker of the House, or that was the first time I ever saw him. And that was just 2 or 3 or 4 years ago. I mean, and I finished, I'm up through episode 7 of 8 of this True Detective, which is good. It's not great, but he is great in it.
Well, he was fantastic in Moonlighting. Is it Moonlight that won the Oscar last year? Yeah, Moonlight. Thank you. He was fantastic in that. That was a really good, you know. But you know, I got to say, it won Best Foreign Film. Roma is really worth watching. I thought of the movies I've seen, and I've seen most of them, was the best one of all.
Let's go to John in Boston. You're next on Boston Public Radio. We're very depressed. Very few people are calling about the performance of Shallow.
Well, actually, we are getting some emails.
Oh, we are.
Find them, yes, about people that agree with us, Jim.
Okay, but John, continue. Welcome.
Yes, sir.
Hi.
I just wanted to say, the remote on my TV melted with Bradley Cooper.
Are you making fun of us or you agree with us?
It melted in my hand. I was left with a twisted mass of black plastic.
Me too.
You're our kind of guy. I think he's mocking us, but whether he is or not, we're really glad you called.
Well, would you
John.
Like to weigh in, John? Jim has confessed his favorite sex scenes ever. The most erotic thing he ever saw is dung beetles mating. I thought the Lady Gaga thing was pretty good.
Was the movie, yeah,
it was. It was incredible.
Are you being serious or sarcastic?
Me? I'm talking about Cooper and
Lady Gaga.
So you're being serious.
He is Gaga, being serious,
yes.
Obviously.
Okay. Not Jim's fantasies.
Well, it's not a fantasy. It's a movie. It's Microcosmos. You know, you should check it out
this.
Before you criticize
you
it, John.
Say,
thank you.
Who else,
what?
Jim, has fantasies about dung beetles?
Dung beetles. I don't fantasy. By the way, he said fantasy.
You may be
I don't fantasies
unique.
About them all. No, I don't. Not unique, and I don't have fantasies about them. I said it was a very sexy scene in a setting that you would not ordinarily consider
okay,
to be
Jim.
That sexy.
Each to his own.
Have you ever seen the damn movie,
variety,
Marjorie? Have you seen the movie?
Diversity. I have.
Oh, what'd you think of the scene?
I guess I wasn't quite as wrapped up in the dung.
Maybe you should see it again.
Okay.
Sadly, we're out of time.
Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. You can always find us by way of our podcast. Tune in live on iTunes or the App Store.
Bradley
tomorrow,
Cooper looked like one of the dung beetles. I just, now that I hadn't thought about that until recently, but.
Okay. We're going to be at the Boston Public Library tomorrow at 11:30. It's our Boston Public Radio Book Club. We're talking about the autobiography of Malcolm X with Alex Beam, the Reverend Irene Monroe as well. Then at 12:30, Attorney General Moore Healy's going to be here to take our questions and your phone calls. We want to thank our crew, Chelsea Murs, Amanda McGowan, Tori Bedford, Jason Dureski, Arjun Singh, our engineer John LaClaw Parker, and our engineering intern is James Gadboys. Who's going to be on TV tonight, Bradley Cooper?
No, actually, the two dung beetles are joining me in the
They don't speak much, but they have an incredible presence. I'm going to continue our conversation with Roger McNamee, former investor, big booster of Facebook, who is now one of their fiercest critics. It was a great discussion this morning. Nicholas Burns, one of my favorites, a former Undersecretary of State, ambassador to NATO. Nick Burns is going to join me to talk about the upcoming summit in Hanoi and what's going on in Venezuela, which is a total horror show. So that's tonight in Greater Boston at 7 o'clock. I'm Jim Browdy.
I'm Marjorie Egan. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please tune again tomorrow and have a great day.